The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
And a very good morning to you. Welcome along this Monday morning. We've got a very, very busy show between now and 9:30. We're packing in goodness that's going to take you all around the world. We're going to talk rugby, we're going to talk football, we're going to talk hurling, we're going to talk about climbing Everest and nearly dying in the skies above Fiji. It is a very busy programme between now and 9:30. If you want to get involved, use the hashtag OTBAM. Owen Sheehan, good morning to you.
Good morning. I think you can take out the word nearly there.
Nearly?
Talk about dying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sorry, yes.
The air
full. What's on the other side? We're going to find out.
Yeah, I mean, very, very, very much looking forward to this Monday morning.
Yeah, we don't always get to find this out.
Very rarely, actually.
One of my favourite scenes in The Sopranos, right? Christopher gets shot and dies.
Spoiler.
No, it's okay. He dies and he gets resuscitated. And he says he was in hell, and hell is St. Patrick's Day every day. Every day is St. Patrick's Day, and he's in an Irish bar, and the Irish are winning every throw of dice. And for this New Jersey Mafia soldier, that's his notion of hell. So I wonder, like, do you go to heaven or do you go to hell when you're in the middle of the mountains over, or the clear blue crystal waters of Fiji?
Maybe the afterlife for everybody is just seeing yourself in an Irish bar and
Hoppers.
The Irish are constantly winning, but for some people that is heaven and for other people that is hell. So
for
it all depends on your
vantage point. We're on the right
point.
Side, yeah.
So we can ask Jason Black that later on, what his view on an Irish bar is.
We won the genetic lottery by being born in this tiny part, and the whole afterlife is actually funneled through the 32 counties.
And that's why we're a nation of such believers.
Exactly, because we've all been dead at some point or other. We're going to talk about Manchester City, obviously. News broke late Friday afternoon that they were being fined $25 million and banned for 2 seasons from the Champions League. They've obviously announced they're going to appeal that. But very quickly over the course of the weekend, some key figures in English football have decided that they're very interested in what's going to happen here. Jose Mourinho was straight out and said, "Oh, does that mean we win the title now for 2018? We finished second," which is the most Jose Mourinho thing that you're ever going to hear. But Steven Gerrard, he is like, wow, his ears pricked up straight away. Suddenly, somebody's hitting rewind on the slip, and he's like, "I didn't slip. It didn't matter." He's very interested for obvious reasons, was what he said. In what happens here? What are the obvious reasons, you think, Owen?
I have no idea what.
What do you think Steven Gerrard thinks the obvious reasons are?
Steven Gerrard is going to get himself a Premier League medal here, and that's he's got the sight of silver in his eyes, the silver sheen of a Premier League medal in his eyes right now.
Is that possible? Is it possible that they strip Manchester City, that Liverpool and Manchester United combine for the first time to be joint complainants ever? Like they would be as one for the first time in football history.
Well, I was thinking about this, and this all is very similar to what we've seen with Saracens recently.
Well, hang on, because this is important, right? Because I'm like, what will the effect on Steven Gerrard's career be? He goes from being one of the great losers of English football to suddenly we have to go, "This is the greatest footballer that England's ever produced."
No,
in Steven Gerrard's head it is.
No, that's
this is what he thinks.
But like, before we get into the reality here of whether or not that would have happened, no. Like, the getting stuff in retrospect does not mean this.
It doesn't.
Ask any Olympian who's been upgraded.
I'm sorry, yeah.
They will consider themselves by their title. And
they
you know,
are not Steven Gerrard. They are not Brendan Rodgers. Brendan Rodgers is suddenly...
There's a big difference here between Steven Gerrard's self-appreciation and our appreciation of Steven Gerrard, I would imagine.
No, I think that you're going to find that if Steven Gerrard can somehow get his hands on this medal, that changes everybody's perception in his head of Stevie G. Well, he won a league. He won a league title. He broke. He carried that team. And Fernando Torres.
He climbed the mountain first, so that Sadio Mane and Mo Salah could
Am I mistaken
follow.
This year? 2014. What's 2014?
It was 2014, yes. Yeah. Steven Gerrard is a Premier League winner in hindsight. It does not change my view of Steven Gerrard.
Well, it changes Steven Gerrard's view.
The slip still exists.
And Steven Gerrard's going to come around to your house and make sure you change your mind. And he's going to tell everybody in every communication that if it hadn't been for the cheating that was going on at Manchester City, they would have won the league. They're the rightful champions. It's like Carl Lewis. He is the rightful champion from Seoul, right? I mean, you know, well, learn a little thing too about that. Aftermath, but anyway... He thinks he's the rightful winner.
But the soul is a different
He's got the gold
situation.
Medal. Is it?
That's like a... No. That's an extremely dramatic...
It's an obvious... It's an
very
obvious...
Whereas some Manchester City fans will come out and say, well, you know, it's a couple of million quid here or there. We would have won the league either way. I disagree with that point of view. But I also disagree with the point of view that, like, you can just rewrite history and that Steven Gerrard can feel a Premier League winner at this point. And like, how does that differ from his own point of view? Like, carrying a team through the Champions League group stages against Olympiacos and then eventually winning against AC Milan in Istanbul. Like, that created enough of an identity as a footballer for
Steven Gerrard. And here's the point at the end of it where he goes, look what I fulfilled. I put this city on my shoulders and it weighed me down, but eventually I carried them to the glory that they deserved. And they were the ones that broke the famine, not this current team who are just coasting off the back of my greatness. I am Liverpool. I am better than Kenny Dalglish. I am the greatest Liverpool player of all time. And it would, sorry, I mean, legitimately, it would have transformed our view of Liverpool. It was the Suarez team, of course. It was Suarez and Sturridge, and Raheem Sterling would get a medal, which would be kind of ironic. Henderson was playing that season as well. Victor Moses and that team, Coutinho, that's that team from 2014. Kolo Touré. I think that if they had won that league, it would transform how we think about Liverpool. It would transform how we think about that management team. It would transform. It would.
No.
Absolutely.
No. Not in hindsight. If they had won that league at the time, of course it would have.
But here's the thing. They are going to claim that they have access to that glory and,
of course they will,
and that title. And Jose Mourinho is going to do exactly the same. Imagine if Man United had won the league under Jose Mourinho. He'd still be there. He'd be there forever.
But Jose Mourinho, if he had like he's clearly being tongue in cheek claiming the 28. He was laughing as he said it last night.
Yeah.
And it'd be a very typical Jose thing to do. Nobody would take him seriously. So by that same token, why would we take Liverpool seriously if they went back and said, this is now our Premier League crown? Okay, technicality rules that you did, that you did win that Premier League title. But nobody will actually believe that was the case. Nobody will. Well, of course, it'll be a little asterisk beside Manchester City's Premier League title. But maybe Steven Gerrard will believe it. But it's a very different thing to expect Liverpool fans to actually believe it. This is their first.
I guarantee you, Sky Sports News, if they could just get it awarded before this one is won, which obviously won't happen.
But
Sky Sports News will find a bunch of Liverpool fans to celebrate that.
But just on that point, I've got every hope that the Premier League will actually strip Manchester City of that title.
Both of them.
Because they've looked at
all of them.
They've looked at the Saracen situation and they've been like, yeah, that's fun. Deducting points, relegating a team. We're going to go one better and actually strip them. Football always needs to have the higher ground. I couldn't believe when the news came out on Friday night, but actually it makes perfect sense. And Premier League are looking at UEFA saying, yeah, I will see your banning of championships or banning of taking part in your future tournaments, and I will raise you one stripping of championship.
All right, very quickly, the news from overnight. Rory McIlroy did not win at the Genesis Invitational overnight. A final round of 73, 2 over par, saw him finish on 8 under in a tie for 5th. The new world number 1 held a share of the league going into the final round of the competition that was eventually won by Australian Adam Scott on 11 under, giving him back-to-back victories. Tiger Woods finished up last at 11 over and 22 strokes off the lead. So not in great form for Tiger at the moment. Mikel Arteta says he hasn't given up hope yet of finishing in the Champions League qualifying places, and who knows, fifth might be good enough. Their 4-0 win against Newcastle yesterday afternoon means they're 7 points adrift of Chelsea, who are fourth in the Premier League table. But if City's ban from European club competitions is upheld, qualification obviously extends to fifth. Mick McCarthy's going to have a nervous wait over the fitness of Kieran Clarke, who was injured twice in about 5 minutes yesterday. Listen to the commentary that the lads had in that game. He had a knee injury that looked like it was fairly serious, got up, ran it off, and then got an ankle injury 2 minutes later. So it seems serious, it doesn't look good. Steve Bruce said they'll know more in the next 24 to 48 hours, obviously. Spurs are up to fifth and into the Champions League qualification places at the moment. They beat Villa 3-2 with a last-minute howler, giving Son the opportunity to stick it past the brilliant Pep Reina in goals for Villa, who saved a penalty before Son managed to bundle in the rebound. Massive game of the league tonight. Chelsea welcome Manchester United to Stamford Bridge. United beat them 4-0 the last two times these two sides met in the opening weekend of the season. Things have changed since then. Kickoff is at 8 o'clock and updates across the day on Off the Ball tonight on News Talk. In Gaelic Games, Cork sit third in Group A of Division 1 of the Allianz National Hurling League this morning. They just beat Westmeath 3-12 to 1-14. And Clare top of Group B. They beat Eddie Brennan's Laois Cusick Park 17-9 with Tony Kelly going off again. Kilkenny sit one place above Wexford on goal difference despite Davy Fitz's side beating Kilkenny by 2 points yesterday. Wexford Park finished 116 to 114. Ryan O'Dwyer is going to join us in studio a little bit later to talk to us about that. And in ladies football, Mayo have 2 wins from 3 in Division 1 of the Lidl Ladies National Football League. They beat Waterford by 6-2 in terrible conditions in Swinford yesterday. Tip, meanwhile, got their first win of this year's campaign, beating Westmeath 11-1-6 in Banshee. And Sean Murphy beat Kieran Wilson 9-1 yesterday evening to claim the Welsh Open. Here's what's coming up for you on the show this morning. Ryan O'Dwyer is going to join us in about 10 minutes' time to look back at the weekend's hurling and talk about the state of the game. The sin bin has become a big issue, referred to as hilarious, and he didn't mean it, by Brian Cody in the aftermath of yesterday's defeat to Wexford. Top five stories of the day that we're covering for you this morning here on Off the Ball and on our website, offtheball.com. Football with Kenny at 20 past eight. We'll get his reaction to Manchester City news. Alan Quinlan is going to join us as we, well, it's a triple crown decider for Ireland against England at the weekend. We start our countdown to that. Sam Lee is going to talk to us about his remarkable career running around the world, climbing mountains and generally being the Irish Bear Grylls. And sorry, Sam Lee's going to talk to us about Man City. Jason Black is going to talk to us at 9:15 about all that. Sam Lee's going to talk to us about Man City. It's Sam Lee of The Athletic. Little bit carried away.
Maybe he does that as well.
Yeah, well, that would be an interesting little sideline for sports journalists not noted for that kind of stuff. Right, time for the papers. OTB AM. Back page of The Star starting for you this morning. You've got to go. It's Alessandro Del Piero telling Pep Guardiola that he's got to go. He's got to join Juventus. Pep Guardiola obviously making the right noise at the moment that he's going nowhere. He's going to sit with Manchester City and grind this one out. The headline in the English Star is, our team who finished second in 2018 going to be champions now? Jose's jibe over City ban. Many's the word spoke true in jest. That's what I'm thinking there. Jose's just putting that out there. And Lochnan, Ennis yesterday was irresponsible. Conditions were as bad as I've ever experienced. And then obviously we're looking at a fixtures backlog. What are we at? 17th of February at the moment. And it's going to be a difficult April for club month.
It sure will. We'll get into that with Ryan O'Dwyer very shortly. It is hurling on the back page of the Irish Independent as well. Storm Davy rips up script. Of course, Davy Fitzgerald saying afterwards, said record means nothing to us. And it's only the league. But still, an ecstatic Davy Fitzgerald there.
The record of having beaten Kilkenny six times in a row?
Well, not having lost them. Sorry. In six consecutive games. It's very much, this rivalry is going one way at the moment. And in any big championship match, you certainly don't feel that Brian Cody has any sort of aura over Davy Fitz in this regard. I think that the Brian Cody aura has gone nowhere. I think you look at the All-Ireland semi-final last year, for example. But over Davy Fitzgerald, I think his power has weakened considerably. And Wexford, the number one team in Leinster now, I think it's fair to say. Not now, but I think it's just further proof that that is certainly the case.
Right. I feel a power rankings coming on.
Yeah, let's do it this week. We keep saying we'll do that and we never get around to it.
Well, I mean,
my fault.
7:43 this morning here, taking you through the Irish Times. Fitzgerald delight as Wexford dig deep to see off Kilkenny in fairly horrific conditions, but it was worth it, I think. Ireland's informed back row trio set to be retained. So Gerry Thorney says only one change for the England game from Ireland's squad perspective, and that's Max Deegan dropping out of the match day 23. Caelan Doris coming onto the bench, which means Peter Mahoney keeps his place. And Solskjaer, unable to confirm that Pogba will play for Manchester United again, this is ahead of the Chelsea game tonight at 8 o'clock. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is refusing to say that. Of course, I'd like to say that as soon as he gets fit, he'll be good enough to play, and I'm sure Paul's desperate to play for us again. Didn't actually say that he would.
Irish Examiner this morning leads with a fantastic photograph from Wexford Park yesterday. Above and beyond, Davy delight as Wexford and Kilkenny whip up a storm. Jack Anderson is writing about the slow but sure winning race in GAA administration. There's tribute to plenty to Gareth Fitzgerald in the Irish Examiner this morning. Sun shining, Spurs snatch dramatic late winner while Arsenal hit four. And Derby delight, upper hand star of the show at Clonmel. Of course, yesterday, Tiger Roll made his return to racing. Tom Malone will be with us later on to give us a lowdown on that.
The Times of London. Guardiola will stay and fight despite ban, but it's the subheadline. Gerrard hints at retrospective action over 2014 title. I'm sure they'll appeal, so we'll wait and see what the outcome is on that, said Steven Gerrard. Then we'll see whether the Premier League act. If you look at the severity of the punishment from UEFA, something has gone badly wrong. Until I get the punishment from the Premier League, I won't comment. But I'm really, really interested in it for obvious reasons. Because he thinks he's going to win the title. And he thinks everybody's going to retrospectively go, well, Steven Gerrard, you've got a league title and a Champions League. That catapults you to greatness. You broke the famine. You're the greatest Liverpool player of all time. That's what he thinks.
Who deserves more credit, Brendan Rodgers or Steven Gerrard?
Well, I mean, it's an orgy of credit that they'll be giving each other.
Do they do like a retrospective?
Luis Suarez bouncing in, by the way, going, lads, settle.
Well, do they fly the likes of Coutinho and Suarez in, get an open top bus and
yes!
celebrate this now?
Yes! I mean, wouldn't you? Did you see this? Like, there was the chief executive. Is it the Liverpool chief executive had to come out and say, "Look, we're not signing Steven Gerrard on a 5-day contract." Did you see that? That was a real thing. I mean, Mary Hannigan's reporting it today. That was that Liverpool fans have been like, "Oh, sign Stevie G so we can win a medal," and he's like, "Really? I have to actually talk about this in public? No."
The Mirror is Juve got to go. Pep, Alessandro Del Piero among the voices telling him to go to Juventus. Pep Guardiola privately, it seems, not so keen on going there for the time being. We'll wait until the appeal is heard, I'd imagine. Another farce at Villa is the headline on Aston Villa 2, Tottenham 3. And Clark a doubt for playoff after a serious ankle knock. It did not look good yesterday for Kieran Clark coming off against Arsenal. And Cody's black humour on new rules. Brian Cody and David Fitz, I think it's fair to say, very much against the idea of a black card in hurling.
The Telegraph, perfect sun. Striker stoppage time winner put Spurs in sight of Champions League. Heartbreak for Villa, really, but they were out on their feet and couldn't just keep Spurs. Just couldn't hoof the ball clear in the 92nd minute. Just
it was a shocking error.
Just hoof it. And he played so well up to that point, so. Now look.
It is that story on the back of the Guardian. Sun strikes to put Spurs fifth, and City are suffering. Mikel Arteta has been speaking about this, revealing Guardiola's heartache at European ban. So, he's talking about, he says, "I was shocked in being in contact with Pep and the people at the club that I know. I feel for them because I know they are suffering. I just want the best for Manchester City because that is the way I feel. I don't think we know at the moment what can happen. If there is any further action for other clubs, I don't want to guess."
Good headline in the back of the Daily Mail this morning. City are united. Euroban won't force Pep or his players out. Now, that's what they're saying. They've got three different reporters working on this. Other papers are saying that Pep fears his best players will be forced out by this move. That, you know, now's the time for the agents of some of those players to go, right, I don't actually want to not play in Europe. And I also don't want to be associated, damaged by association with this regime, which has obviously boobed so spectacularly.
Mm. Yeah, it will all come down to money at the end of the day, won't it? Like, will there be compensation for the Champions League clauses in certain players' contract or European trophies? If they can make that up, they might stay. And then also the prestige that perhaps comes with their endorsements by not being on the biggest stage midweeks, for example.
But you'd also then immediately make them favourites for the next two league titles if everybody stays, right? On the basis that they don't have to go to wherever midweek and play. They're resting their players.
Unless Liverpool just continue to exist at the level they exist at. Because even Manchester City without the Champions League might struggle against this sort of form. Especially because they won't be able to sign all the players they would have been able to sign. Great headlines on the back of the Irish Sun this morning. Del's boy, Juve legend Al, it's Pep's destiny to boss us. And tab of the morning to you, Black Talk Downed. Brian Cody and David Fitzgerald have hit out of the plans to introduce a black car to hurling.
The boy in hurdle is the front page cover of the Racing Post. Supporting role, Elliot Thrill as Tiger rolls home in fifth on return behind stablemate Cracking Smart. And Davey Russell was on board Cracking Smart. And Keith Donoghue, we had in studio for Friday Night Racing, very happy with the performance of Tiger Roll coming in fifth. Obviously, Tiger Roll goes to Cheltenham and then we'll end up going to Aintree as well.
And Herald is the final one for me. Mane Steele, return of Liverpool superhero, massive boost, says Gomez. And also, great little heading at the top here, farcical scenes as big Dublin derby tie descends into chaos. We'll get into the Daily Mail fallout very shortly. Dan McDonald's got a good piece of it in the papers today.
Two last ones, the Irish News for you there. Headline this morning, McKernan, GAA must find better structure for Championship. Everybody thinks that at this point, so you would hope that eventually some kind of consensus emerge and boys get the job done. So Celtic marching towards a ninth consecutive SPL, Scottish Premier League title. And then the last one is on offtheball.com this morning. Munich air disaster hero Harry Gregg dies at 87. So the legendary Manchester United goalkeeper who was considered one of the heroes after the Munich air disaster when he sifted through the wreckage to help survivors and then went on to have a brilliant career for Northern Ireland and of course with Manchester United as well, has passed away at the age of 87. Obviously tributes flowing into him. We'll bring you some of the archive material that we have with Harry Gregg from years past as we get to it today a little bit later on. So if you want to get in touch this morning, you can use the hashtag OTBAM former Dublin hurler Ryan O'Dwyer joins us in studio next. First, here's Cliona Foley, presenter of Off the Bench, and Mark Gallagher of the Irish Mail on Sunday in studio for the Sunday Paper Review, talking about the GPA calling out the GAA after Tom Ryan's annual report.
I'm with them on this, and I'd rarely agree a lot of. I don't agree a lot with Colin O'Rourke on things, but I do agree with him in this case. It's like they took offence at something that actually nobody was giving offence to. Tom Ryan was saying the costs associated with intercounty are spiralling, and we've got to get a hold on them. The GPA then came out and said, you know, we're the people who are creating all of this, and we're your most important asset, and you can't be basically saying, without saying it, you shouldn't be criticising us. But he wasn't criticising them, and I think that's the mistake. But you know, this point about the GPA we're making, that we're the revenue generating machine that allows the GAA to compete with rugby and soccer and other sports. First of all, nobody was saying that this was their fault. The fault is with managers, I think. The fault is with people building up these huge backroom teams that are costing so much money, and also maybe in how they're spending the money.
And as Tom Ryan acknowledged, the length of the season.
The length of the season, the fixtures.
His hands up,
this is exactly, he did make that point. But what I thought was really missing in the GPA statement was not only did they seem to be taking offence at something that wasn't meant to be, wasn't criticising them, but also they were also leaving out, which doesn't help their case, they were leaving out the other vital thing, which is the volunteers in the GAA. And so the GAA's wealth isn't just built on the intercounty player, it's built on the back of all those people in all those clubs who help and coach and get kids to a point where they can become great. And I think that's a mistake to leave them out of the thing. Yeah.
52 minutes past 7 here this morning on OTBM. Delighted to say Ron O'Dwyer is with us to talk about the weekend's hurling. Ryan, how are you?
Good, yeah.
Are you a believer in the black card? Is that something that you think?
No.
I've yet to meet somebody who has ever hurled who actually thinks the black card is a good idea for hurling.
Well, when you're making a decision like they're going to make, well, first of all, if you're making that decision, test it out in the Walsh Cup or the Waterford Crystal. There's no need to, I know the way Congress is on in late February that they can't really do that, but like, put it in place now for next year's Walsh Cup or whatever. But there's no need to be bringing it in now for the end of the league and start a championship or anything like that. Like, it's just throwing everything off kilter. But when you're making a decision like this, you ask, I suppose, the main contributors to it, the main people in it, and that's the players. None of the players want it. None of the managers want it. And I don't think there's any players that are going to go out there and do the cynical things that they're talking about at the highest level, at intercounty level, because it's such a fast game. I might get crucified for this now, but football is a bit of a slower game, and it's a lot more tactless. It's like
there's more opportunity to be cynical.
There's more opportunity. It's like American football. Everything is structured. So there's a lot more opportunity. Hurling, yeah, you'll have your cornerback pulling and dragging when the ball is up the other end of the pitch and the ball is dropping in between you, you're fighting for the ball, but it's more of a raw aggression.
So yeah. Mostly it doesn't happen, but when it does happen, what is a suitable punishment?
Oh, well, you're probably asking the wrong person there. Play on.
I actually thought that as a forward you would have been in favour of, so because there's definitely instances where somebody gets dragged down when they're through.
The Clare Leash game yesterday, for example, like we saw.
Yeah. This time of the year, anything can happen because the conditions yesterday, some lads are barely able to feel their hands. But I think during the summer, if it's obvious, like a lad throwing goal and being dragged down, which it does happen. I think have your punishment, have your free yellow card, whatever. But I'm not a fan of the idea of someone going off for 10 minutes. Now, if it happens to the opposition and I'm playing, then I'd be all for it. But as a whole, I'm not for it. And I think if you ask the main resources of the game, the players, none of them are for it either. So I think the decision maker should really listen to the players in this. And the managers are calling for it as well. There will be cynical play, but you don't hear any of the players complain.
Why not, though?
I think it's just the way hurling is.
I agree with you, right? Except that you can see that there's a benefit to cynical play. And we've seen in all sports, unless you punish cynical play, players are going to get more and more cynical.
Yeah, I suppose...
Kerry still complained about somebody not taking
Kavanagh doing the rugby tackle,
not taking McManaman down when he was making the run. Like, you know, it's your job to be cynical.
Yeah, I agree, but you have to ask the question. I know you're saying that if cynical play creeps in, it's going to stay going worse and worse. But I think you have to ask the question, is the cynical play bad enough in hurling that you need to introduce the black card? Personally, I don't think it is. People will, they'll play on the edge, or if at that level, they should be playing on the edge. But I just don't think...
Something's going to happen in an All-Ireland semi-final or final.
Yeah, well,
and it's going to be one of the traditional powerhouses who win in All-Ireland, because they're better at this kind of stuff. That's going to stop a Wexford or a Dublin or a Clare or even a Limerick winning the second one.
It's
Cork or Tipperary and Kilkenny are going to benefit from this in a big game, and everyone's going to go, Jesus.
Yeah, it's the dark arts of the game that you learn.
Not that dark, they're very public.
I don't know, there's a few things you do and you don't get caught. No, it's those things, but it's like, look, if you're going down on a ball and you see someone there to give your lad an opportunity, grab your man's hurley or whatever, that's part of the game. A lad threw on goal with a minute to go and a rugby tackle, that's not part of the game. And
so what happens in that instance? That's fair.
Yeah. I can see why they're...
Do you make it a penalty? Would a penalty rather than 10 minutes be fine?
Well, then you have it's all about the discretion of the ref then.
And people start diving. I mean, hurlers aren't going to dive,
that's, it's in the game as it is.
I would book everybody who dives. If there was a black card, it should be... Maybe it's just a penalty. Anybody who dives gives away a penalty, no matter where it is in the pitch. And likewise, a rugby tackle or a clear goal-scoring opportunity denied is a penalty.
I agree 100% with that, but that's going to cause arguments as well, because it's like everything. There's one man in the middle of the pitch that dictates all this.
Yes.
And look, not for love nor money, never would I become a ref, because no matter what they do, I can't curse here. No matter what they do, someone will think they're wrong anyway. I don't know, would a way of introducing that, maybe a ref on each side of the pitch?
Or empower the umpires and make them referees.
Yeah, I agree 100% with you there, but you see at intercounty level, a lot of them are the 60-year-olds wearing the glasses that are out for the day. Maybe make them do a course as well. I don't know. Make them do. Maybe they have to be qualified referees. Just not at intercounty level. Maybe a club ref, but someone that knows the rules can contribute to the decisions that the ref makes.
That makes sense.
But the black card, I'm still not a fan of it. And the simple reason is because I suppose I'm traditionalist in this when I say this, but hurling, like a lad that used to coach Dublin there a couple of years ago, Ross Dunphy, he's a Wexford man and he came from a football background. But I asked him one day, what do you find the difference between the hurlers and footballers? He just said, hurling is just, it's a warrior's game. And there's an honesty to it. I know lads might be pulling and there might be a bit of cynical play, but by and large, because it's a quicker game, you don't really get the time to be too cynical. And if there is someone throwing goal at the last minute and you're up by 2 points, you will pull them down and hopefully they don't score the goal. And I think, it is cynical, but I think it's doing everything for the cause. Maybe I'm shooting myself in the foot there, but I'm contradicting myself. I know I am, by saying it's part of the game and it is cynical, but I just think introducing a black card is going to cause more trouble than it's worth, because there's a massive grey area there. And you see it in football. I know it's a lot better, but you see it in football.
It will entice people to dive?
I don't think it will entice, no.
So what's the fear?
It's those 50-50 calls that will I give a yellow card or will I give a black card? And I think that's where it will, and it's back on the referee again. What you interpret as a yellow card, what you interpret as a black card, and you're on about happening in All-Ireland semi-final. If it happens there, it's in the spotlight. We saw last year Kilkenny against Limerick, the linesman should have seen the very last ball that got touched off Killian Buckley's hurley and out for 65. That costs that cost, I'm not saying it cost Limerick the game, but it cost them a chance of going into extra time or whatever. Well, Kilkenny could have won anyway. But it's still, it's those inches, and I think if it's not broken, don't fix it. I don't think it's broken at the moment.
Okay. Have you ever played in conditions as bad as yesterday?
Yeah. But yes, it was horrible. I personally, and it's just a personal thing, I don't think any of the games should have been on this weekend. Hurling is just like, geez, went training yesterday and you go to catch the ball and you're like, no, hurley to everything now today. Cause it's too cold. But I don't think, you want to see hurling at its best, and it wasn't at its best yesterday. Now, some cracking games, but it wasn't at its best yesterday because the conditions didn't facilitate it. Like you saw the Clare game there, I think there was just over 1,000 people at the match. Like, is that doing anyone any favour? And you wonder how many of them were actually family of the players and all that.
Yeah,
like,
they have to be there.
You'd wonder how many supporters would want to go to a game when the conditions are like that. I know I didn't fancy it anyway, but I suppose you have to ask the question then, if you do call off the game, when do you facilitate it? Like, the fixture calendar is very condensed as it is. That's another debate.
So why do we have quarterfinals and semi-finals in the hurling league then?
Personally, I wouldn't have the quarterfinals. I'd have the semi-finals. Like, you get enough chance. You might say that then that towards the end of the league there's going to be a few dead rubber games and a fifth playing sixth or whatever, and it's a dead rubber game, which I agree with. Yeah, or you could have a relegation. Like, you could, the same weekend as the quarter final, you could have the bottom two playing. And then the weekend of the final, then the loser of both of them from each side of the league playing in the relegation final or whatever. I think with the quarter final in there, I think it's a wasted weekend that you could have had a semi final, and then you're back to the clubs, facilitating the clubs a little bit better.
Presumably, the manager will actually find some value in those games. Like, it beats training, having a quarter final, which will be relatively competitive.
Yeah, but there's only going to be 4 teams in the quarter final.
So it's four inter-county setups benefiting from this, and everybody else kind of losing a week of club
fixtures. And I think the way the championship is structured now with the round robin, it's a whole different debate. But the way that's structured, I won't say it devalues the league, but it gives you more leeway to find players during the league. Like, the way it was the last couple of years before it has changed is there was a massive emphasis in the league because
you had to be ready to go.
And especially in Division 1A, you didn't want to get relegated, and it was so competitive that you could win the league 1 year, the next year you're relegated. So there was a massive intensity, there was a massive drive to do well in the league. You didn't have to win it, but to do well and just to avoid that drop. Because you're getting higher standard games, and in the first couple of rounds of championship were always a little bit of a downer, and then coming back up for the knockout stages again. But I just think I think the league, the way it is now, I think it's what it should be used for, to find players, develop players. I know that you can't control the weather, but just to find players and have your best team for the championship.
At times though, we are getting great encounters, and if it was a good day yesterday in Wexford Park, we would have got a brilliant game. I think even in the conditions it was very exciting. According to John Fogarty's match report, there was booming dance music coming out of the Wexford dressing room after the encounter. This matters to Davy Fitz. He will say that the record doesn't mean anything at all, no losses in 6 games against Brian Cody, but this matters. Like, winning that game yesterday was huge for Wexford.
I think psychologically it's massive, because I always compare Kilkenny, and it's probably the same when I was playing with Dublin. Kilkenny are like the All Blacks. It's the whole aura about them. It's the culture about them. It's they nearly have a lot of teams bet before the game even starts, because it's Kilkenny. Especially we'll say the early 2000s, mid 2000s. The players they had then were phenomenal. But that whole aura about them continued. And I think if Wexford, and if it becomes a habit with them that they're used to beating Kilkenny, they won't have that fear. They won't have that fear that a lot of teams have against the All Blacks when it comes to rugby. I think it meant a lot to him. I think it meant an awful lot to Wexford yesterday. And you could see it in Davy's face. But like, Davy would be arguing with a bag of crisps if there was something crumpled in it. Like, he'd be just But he's just that way. But like, he's so passionate about it, and everyone feeds off that. Like, you're saying the music was blaring in the dressing room after. I have no doubt there was music going before, and in the dressing room there was a bit of banter. He creates a great atmosphere, and this is speaking not just people in the Wexford dressing room, people in the Clare dressing room, people previously in the Waterford dressing room. He creates a bit of a, I suppose, a few situations, kind of an us against them situation, a siege mentality. He definitely creates that, and you can see that in every interview he gets. Everyone is conspiring against him. But I think in a dressing room, it's like he creates a family situation where it's a situation that every team should want to get to, but I don't think everyone has the power to create that environment. But he definitely has that, where it's a family, it's all us, we're in this together. And you know, I think the game against Kilkenny will stand to him. Now, it is adding fuel to fire for Kilkenny when they come up against Wexford again, because you don't want to give Kilkenny any motivation. But I think psychologically they're not going to fear Kilkenny now, especially what I think the last six times they've played, they've won five of them and drew one or something similar to that.
How did you manage to break down the aura of the All Blacks element of Kilkenny?
Well, I tell you, we had a great man in with us at one stage, Declan Coyle. I'm sure you've heard of him, the Green Platform. I'm just plugging his book there, The Green Platform. He was in with us. He gave us a belief, and I suppose gave us a confidence in ourselves. And then who we had in the sideline was Anthony Daly, and like, he's another cut from... I've never met a St. Clair person, to be honest. So I've said that plenty in the past. They're all there's a screw missing with all of them. I think the further west you go, it's just they're all crazy, but especially Clare. But I think just having him on the sideline, and just every match we played with Dalo, whether it was a challenge or championship or league, whatever it was, it was a war. And you know that, and I've been quoted as saying this, you know that if you're in the trenches with Dalo, that he'll be the first out, because you know he'll do anything for you. Do you know? And that we fed off that. So I think there's a few things that got us over the hump against Kilkenny. But then, like, we might go out the couple of weeks after, play him again, and we'd be brutal. We weren't consistent. Maybe that was a psychological thing as well. We were believing too much in our own hype. But I suppose that's another story as well. But
we can come back to that sometime. I want to ask about Tony Kelly, because whatever about Wexford feeling the benefit of it, Tony Kelly's going to feel the benefit of 8 points. Half of them, weren't from freeze.
Four from play, and like, he was everywhere. Like, he was. There was times he's back in the full back line, he'd scored a point, you swear he was playing corner forward. He was an engine up and down the field. I think having him midfield gives him freedom where he can go anywhere. Mm. Like, he used to be playing centre forward, and you see him coming back nearly in the half back line a lot, but he was more restricted. That, like, right, you can come back, but you have to revert back up to centre forward. I think with him midfield, it gives him the freedom, the license just to go wherever he wants. And like, you'd nearly, if you're playing against him, forget about Clare, if you're just playing against him, you'd nearly sacrifice a player that's right. You have to follow him no matter where, just to cancel him out. Like,
and very hard to do though, right?
It's very hard to do that, because any player, they want to hurl themselves. So it is very hard to do as a manager. It's very hard to do as a player. Especially when you see Tony Kelly, that's a hard job anyway. But yeah, it's. I think.
Is he fast?
He's probably faster than me. That's not hard though. I think he just, like, he has a turn. You saw there, yes, he scored a point, and it came out, it was hand passed back out to him, and he went on to his right. And then he kind of sold the man. Like, he didn't even go to hit it, but you thought he was going to hit it, and then turned. And all of a sudden, he had 6-7 yards of space. He's very similar to Dermot Connolly. Like, Dermot Connolly isn't overly fast, but he turns, and all of a sudden, he's got loads of space. And he never looks like he's rushing at him. Tony Kelly's the exact same. He never looks like he's trying to do anything too quick. He's in his own comfort zone, which I suppose this comes to a psychological thing as well. He set his standard high. His comfort zone is someone else's, oh, I don't know what's going on here.
He's only 26. I had to look it up there just to make
scary.
Sure.
It's
like
scary.
This should be his peak.
Yeah, he's you'd imagine he's hitting his peak now. Like my first intro, I didn't hear him until 2012. We played Clare down in Cusack Park, and he scored the winning goal in the qualifiers. And like, who the hell is this lad? Like, I never even heard of him before. It seems like ages ago, and he's still only 26. Like, yeah. it's crazy. But look, I think he's hitting his prime years now. And if he can get the supporting cast around, I'm not saying it's going to be a one man show, because Clare had a lot of performers yesterday. Now, like, there was a lad cornerback Curry, never really heard of him, and I thought he was phenomenal yesterday. Shanahan, when he came on, was just phenomenal, and there was a few McInerney out to midfield. I suppose I played against him, and I was full forward, he was full back, and I was like, I hate this lad. So as a full forward, I'd be delighted to see him go out the pitch, but like, he played really well yesterday. Like, if you'd have said it to me beforehand, I'd have said, do you know, I'd be keeping him full back, maybe centre back, whatever. But seeing him yesterday, I was like, yeah, do you know, you're onto something here. So I think he does have a supporting cast around him, but like, the way he carries himself, the hurling he does, and he's not greedy. Like, he lets the ball off. He's not, oh, I'm going to go on a solo run here, I'm going to take a shot from 90 yards. Under pressure, he'll let the ball in and he'll take a score when he has a chance.
It's interesting how that middle third in hurling at the moment seems to be a fairly fluid thing, because you talk about Tony Kelly going between 11 and midfield. If you look at the Dublin game, then you've got a load of scores coming from Ryan McBride in midfield. You've got Chris Crummy, who I think was wearing 6 but is playing as a centre forward essentially.
Yeah, he started the game midfield, right. But then in the second half he went centre forward a couple of times. I don't know, like you said, it's hard to see in a game. The kind of, I'll say the half forwards in midfield are nearly playing as one unit, but like, it looked as if he was centre forward, but then he was coming back towards the middle of the field. Whether that's an experiment that will work, I don't know. But like, to answer your question, yeah, I think the way hurling is played, lads are hitting the ball further. The ball is a lot better than it was maybe 15, 20 years ago. The striking is better. I think the midfield is nearly being bypassed at some stages. So I think it gives the two midfielders, nearly one of them, a chance to nearly sit and play as 7 backs. One of them has a chance to go forward, play as 7 forwards. And it just, yeah, you saw Ream McBride. What did he score? 2 points anyway. He definitely scored 2. But yeah, he loves shooting anyway, to be honest. But like, he was just driving through the middle the whole time as a support runner. I don't know, have Dublin been working on it, that when someone gets the ball in the half-hour line, that if they can't go themselves, that they know he's going to be running off their shoulder, like a crash ball in rugby or something.
Last question for you about this. How are Dublin doing at the moment? Where are they in their evolution?
If you ask me this next week, I'll give you a better answer, because I think they've played Carlow and Laois, 2 games that they were expected to win. Especially Carlow are missing a few lads, but I think 2 games they're expected to win. The Kilkenny game was very disappointing. Kilkenny are missing so many players. I covered the game that day, and I was very disappointed. Just with the whole manner, whatever about their hurling, it looked like they
weren't ready for the fight.
Yeah, they weren't ready for the fight. Yeah. So I think next week in Croke Park against Wexford, I think that's going to be a gauge on where they stand at the moment, what their hurling's like, how much fight is in them. Because at the end of the day, give me 15 dogged, determined hurlers rather than 15 flashy hurlers. You know, they'll be the ones that will grind out a victory. And I do Dublin have it. I think they do. Have I seen it? I didn't see it in the Kilkenny game. So it remains to be seen. Next weekend is going to be, I think, an eye-opener, hopefully in a good way.
Hopefully the weather's a little bit better next weekend. We actually get to see what it was like. Ryan, good stuff. Thanks a million for popping into us in the studio this morning. Now we're back talking football with Kenny Cunningham in just a minute. OTB
AM. Jack Grealish at times in that game was unplayable, constantly involved. We were a bit frustrated at times. Maybe in the first half he didn't take it on himself and he was unselfish. We got very depressed about Declan Rice leaving the Republic of Ireland. Everyone was upset with Jack Grealish. Like, when you compare the two and where their careers are going right now, like, is Grealish really the one who got away?
I've said from the get-go that we would definitely miss Jack Grealish more than Declan Rice. And not because Declan Rice is not a good player. Jack Grealish is an exceptional footballer. He is 100% going to go to a bigger club than Aston Villa. And that's Villa aren't a big side. They are. They're a huge team in English football. But they're not where he needs to be for his club, his team, or his form to go further. He should be winning things. He's that good. I've trained him for a long time at Villa. And honestly, he's just all round a very good player. And what's improved has been his mentality. He's got stronger about that. He's, you know, off the pitch, he's better with what he does it with himself. And, you know, he comes out and he puts in a performance. Every time he got the ball today, he did something good with it. He really gave the ball away. He was driving at the heart of the defence. And, you know, it absolutely missed a trick for Ireland. And, you know, what would we do to have someone like that on our team now? But, you know, he will go on to play for a huge club. I have no doubt about that.
Oh, yeah. At some point in our lives, we'll all get over the fact that Jack Grealish was on the bench and could have come on and could have played. Anyway, look, let's ignore that. Kenny Cunningham, good morning to you. How you doing?
Morning, lads.
Just very briefly about that Villa game. A defeat like
that... I never
do
that in brief. Yeah, you know that.
I know. A defeat like that in the manner of it where it looks like Pepe Reina has saved a point for them. It's a tough game. The stadium is on fire and everybody's like, ah, this is good. We got a point when we needed it against one of the teams who's gone for Champions League action. To concede in the 92nd minute the way they did with a horrific error from a centre-back who'd actually played quite well in the game, that's the type of thing that killed a team who are fighting against relegation, right?
Yeah, you're right. I think psychologically it does damage Gerard. I thought they were fragile all during the game, particularly defensively. Anytime Spurs made a couple of passes in their half, the pitch got down the sides of the three centre-halves, they looked to be in trouble. I know Mings wasn't fit, but even still, I thought they looked a bit brittle. Drinkwater in midfield just looks as if his legs, he can't get himself up to speed. They missed a couple of key players. McGinn for me is absolutely crucial. Him, the partnership, him and Jack Grealish, funny enough, earlier in the season, playing as those two advanced number eights in central midfield was probably their biggest asset. They need to get him back fit quickly and keep Jack Grealish fit. That's the only chance they have. But I'd really worry for them for them at the moment.
Yeah. So, what about Spurs? How good were they?
Decent, but pretty symptomatic from what I've seen from Spurs of late, or certainly since Mourinho's come in. You can see there's elements of quality within the squad. Jay, you saw the advantage of Son operating as a striker high up the pitch. His ability to drive in behind, use his pace down the sides, which you don't get with Harry Kane, to be honest, which he probably gives you more options than Kane in that respect, of being able to drop in short, link things up and go in behind as well and really stretch teams. But obviously not as good a finisher as Harry Kane. We saw that as well. There's some great chances. Tottenham Hotspur got themselves in some great positions. Ali was bursting forward from that number 10 position, which is his best position, getting into the box, getting on the end of things, but just not good enough, not clinic enough in the last third of the pitch. They've got problems in centre midfield, yeah. They haven't got a naturally holding midfield player. He's looking at Dyer. Dyer is just a bit of a shadow of the player that was there some years ago. Just mobility-wise, he can't get around the pitch. Alderweireld, the greatest player that he has been, just again, he's lost that yard of pace as well. Grealish done him on a couple of occasions. So, yeah, some good stuff there from Spurs. Impressive in some areas of the pitch, but he still needs to do some business in the summer, Mourinho, for me, in key areas of the pitch.
Yeah, it's interesting looking in kind of the overall context of the weekend, Kenny, where exactly things might fall. We've got the Manchester City situation here, whereby if there is a place that opens up in the race for the top four all of a sudden for the Champions League places, it kind of changes the complexion of it entirely, because like Harry Redknapp was saying, for example, last week on TalkSport that Arsenal will qualify or will finish in the top four, and obviously that seemed like such a ridiculous notion. But then this possibility of there being another Champions League place, it turns this slow bike race for the top four into something even more exciting in the Premier League.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a fair point. I don't think a huge amount changes, though, the fact that the fifth place is open up. I don't think the mentality of a number of clubs all of a sudden, Sheffield United, you know, thinking, oh, there's a real chance for us now. Yeah, it does increase the possibility of maybe the likes of Wolves or a team of that stature maybe grabbing that potentially that fifth Champions League place. I'm still not sure it'll happen. It's all hypothetical pie in the sky in terms of whether that's going to be the case. But I don't think it'll affect in terms of the mentality of those clubs going forward. Particularly the ones I've mentioned, Sheffield United, Wolves, they'd be kind of fairy tales if they were to make Champions League. But I think they'll just keep grinding now as they have been. So I don't think the dynamic on is going to change greatly in terms of what you're going to see from those clubs between now and the end of the season. Everyone's just got their heads down and trying to put the type of run together that will get them in as high a position as possible.
What's your take on what happens here in the City situation, Kenny? I know you mentioned there it's kind of pie in the sky stuff at the moment, but if you are a Manchester City player without Champions League football for the next two seasons, it does change your status of the club, doesn't it? It changes the whole status of yourself as a footballer that you won't be able to partake in Europe's top competition.
I'm not buying into that. That's the argument the players will be using and their agents will be using. Oh, his stature's affected now. My client is desperate. Champions League football, dreamt as a child, the playing that, we've got to get out. But look, players do what's good for them at the end of the day. I'm sure we might see now a lot of the comments from Manchester United players, the last couple of years, being totally committed to the badge and totally invested in the football club, totally buying into this kind of project. Then we'll see maybe over the next few months which of those statements kind of ring true. I'm still not convinced it's going to play out as simple as that. Simple two-year ban for Manchester City. There will be an appeal process. Generally speaking, experience tells you that that ban will be maybe half to maybe a 1 year. I think that changes dynamics somewhat. Good to hear Guardiola come out, where it seems to be initially saying he's here regardless, hell or high water. He'll be around for the next 2 years. I think that's exactly what the club needed from the manager. So I hope not. Personally, I hope they don't get banned. Because unfortunately, indirectly, it's the people that really matter, supporters and players actually, who are the most affected by the ban. So I hope that doesn't transpire. But yeah, they've obviously put themselves in a very difficult position. But they're a powerful body, Manchester City. And even if CAS was to rule against them, I don't think they'll let it lie there. I think they'd be appealing even to challenging European law in terms of the rights of UEFA to impose these sanctions, and even financial fair play itself might be up to scrutiny, so it was a long way to go.
Yeah, there's definitely a long way to go. I just wanted briefly to talk about Steven Gerrard. So obviously interviewed after Rangers' win yesterday in the Scottish Premier League, and he says he's very, very interested in what's happening for obvious reasons. Now, he didn't go into those obvious reasons, but everybody is like assuming that he thinks there's some way that maybe Manchester City might be penalised by losing the Premier League titles that they won under this regime. What do you think of that prospect, and what would it mean for Liverpool and for Manchester United?
Well, I suppose what it means is potentially Liverpool will be crowned champions, but it's not easy for me to say. Obviously, I'm not connected, but it's not the way I'd want to win a league title in that respect. And I think, for me, I've probably said it before, for me, I don't think in terms of looking back like that retrospectively, Liverpool players had their opportunity over the course of the season to come out on top of Manchester City. They didn't. Now, I understand the argument that says, well, Manchester City shouldn't have had players, they were paying them, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I understand that argument. There's rules there in place. But ultimately, from a sporting spectacle as a contest, they went up against Manchester City over the course of the season and they came out second best. So for me, that shouldn't change, regardless of what the outcome of this investigation by UEFA and the Court of Arbitration. For me, there shouldn't be kind of retrospective kind of justice dealt to Manchester City. For me, they won the league fairly and squarely on the football pitch, kind of man-to-man over the course of the season. That shouldn't change.
Yeah, it's a bit funny Steven Gerrard's even like floating this balloon, isn't it?
No, I can understand. There's an argument there, Ger. It's a logical argument of, well, they've broken the rules, they've overinflated the sponsorship deals, which enabled them to pay more money to players, they've hidden payments to players and image rights, giving themselves an unfair advantage. So from purely financial terms, yeah, I can understand that argument if it is proved to be true. I think it probably is true. Don't get me wrong, it's hardly a massive surprise, is it? A big surprise to you, Gerrard, is it, in terms of what's actually come out here. But for me, it's a big massive step down in terms of, right, let's look back in terms of what they've won, every trophy they've won during that period of time, let's take it off and let's hand them to the next in line. That becomes almost farcical to me. I think in a sporting context, they actually earned those trophies. The players deserve them, and that should remain intact.
Do you not think for Liverpool's open top bus tour this year, they could have like Brendan Rodgers and Steven Gerrard in another bus behind this year's squad just celebrating the 2014 Premier League title?
Well, Well, maybe if that keeps Steven Gerrard happy, maybe so. Just getting maybe getting towed along in a little hiatus behind the main open top bus if that's what they want. But like I said, that's a pretty hollow feeling. I know we're joking about it, but that's a pretty hollow feeling, isn't it? So yeah, I don't like to hear that kind of conversation, to be honest with you. But yeah, it certainly kind of warrants potential. It'd be interesting to see how it pans out. But I'd be very surprised if we go into next season with the Court of Arbitration upholding UEFA's decision and Manchester City banned for 2 years. There's a long way to go in this process.
The other game yesterday, Arsenal against Newcastle United, Kenny, from an Irish perspective, obviously the Kieran Clarke injury news is probably the most eyebrow-raising. Got injured twice in the game, looked pretty bad. How does that impact Mick McCarthy's thinking for next month?
Probably not greatly, Owen, in all honesty. I think Kieran certainly would have come into contention. I think Mick would be sticking with an orthodox kind of back four. I think if he had been adding three centre-half, certainly Kieran would have pushed him strongly for a starting place. But I think Shane Duffy and John Egan are starting too for the game in Slovakia. So I don't think that'll change. It would have been great to have the option of Kieran. He's a good player. I like Kieran. He's comfortable on the ball, a kind of naturally left-footed player in terms of the balance of the team in that area of the pitch. So, yeah, hopefully he gets back as soon as possible. The blow for him, he's had his injury problems. But in all honesty, I don't think it'll impact on us too much, certainly in the foreseeable future.
I don't know, do you want to talk about Arsenal and how great they looked in the 90th minute? That was like the best final 5 minutes I've seen the team play football all season on.
Well, if you've got players like Alexandre Lacazette and Mesut Ozil scoring goals, Kenny, it surely can't be a bad thing. You've obviously got
36 uninterrupted passes. That was like watching Liverpool of the 1980s.
It was like, yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what
Arsenal and League Cup game.
In the Carling Cup era specifically. Like, you've obviously got more sustainable aspects of this squad, like Bukayo Saka at left-back turning into what looks like an unbelievable talent for Arsenal. And then you have these glimmers like Lacazette and Mesut Ozil. Is it something that perhaps can lead to future success down the line this season? Can they go all the way in the Europa League? Potentially, like, I really still don't buy the idea that Champions League qualification via the Premier League is going to happen for them, because they do have a couple of very, very tricky fixtures.
No, but they're heading in the right direction, Alan. That's the most important thing. There has been improvement there for me under Arteta. You saw it very quickly in terms of just the basic organisation of the team, in terms of the tactical setup of the team. They clearly they're better drilled, but they're certainly taking on board the message from the managers. There's kind of clear thinking in terms of how he wants them to play, the intensity they play at these days, the way they hunt around the pitch. You get physically aggressive with people. There's clearly been a massive upturn in that respect. Some of the younger players there clearly bought in. So you've mentioned there Martinelli as well, didn't play yesterday. A huge talent as well. So they're heading in the right direction. I can't see Champions League this year, apart from obviously through the route of Europa, because I think you can get on a roll. It does happen, lads. You can get on a roll second half of the season. Confidence, keep your key players fit. And that's a competition you can tiptoe your way through. Manchester United did a couple of years ago without playing like scintillating football. And got themselves a European trophy and Champions League qualification. So it is possible for Arsenal. There's still a lot to play for. But the important thing is they're heading in the right direction. It looks like they've got the right man in place, strong character, good coach, good organiser. And that's fundamentally what's been crying out for some time.
Arsenal's win puts them up to 10th. They're just behind Manchester United in the table. Obviously, Man United are playing tonight at Stamford Bridge against Chelsea. This is a very, very big game. If Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to inject some confidence into his entire era at Manchester United, they need to be able to at least credibly challenge for the top four, and there's no way they're going to be able to. It doesn't look like they're going to be able to come back if they lose tonight. So how do Manchester United approach an away game against Chelsea knowing so much is on the line?
I suppose if you're talking about, well, I suppose there's a psychological aspect and a tactical aspect to the game. That comes to the manager, how he sees it. I actually think some of the big games during his tenure there, Jared, I'm thinking back when he first came into the football club, I think tactically he's got a spot on. And probably the Manchester City game earlier this season at the Etihad was the greatest example of that. I thought it was brilliant in terms of the tactical setup of the team on that particular occasion. Big game, huge pressure on the players. I thought he got absolutely spot on. Charles scored, you know, didn't go toe-to-toe with Manchester United, invited them on, played a counter-attacking game, made no apologies for it. It was the right tactic on the night. They broke a Manchester United at pace, opened them up, and were deserved to win it. So that was a brilliant night from Manchester United and Solskjaer in particular. So he kind of needs one of those nights in terms of how he sees the game going. They're never going to dominate possession, although with Fernandez now on the team, looking forward to seeing him play up close, seeing how good he is, because they certainly need definitely need somebody to centre midfield, a bit more creative edge, who can see a pass, who can get beyond the ball into the box and contribute with goals. So really looking forward to see him play up close. But it is a big game for Solskjaer. We've been saying that for some time, lads, haven't we? It's a big game for Solskjaer. He doesn't win this one. Seems as if we've been repeating ourselves for the past 3 or 4 months. Look, he's safe till the end of the season. That's true. But certainly, I think what happens between now and the end of the season will affect the thinking of Ed Woodward going forward. And I think it's simple as this. If he loses the faith and the support of the Manchester United faithful between now and the end of the season, and they make kind of vocal their frustration, I think that's probably the end of them.
Yeah. All right, Kenny, good stuff. We'll let you go. Thanks a million.
Cheers, lads.
Kenny Cunningham there giving us his thoughts on that. It's the definition of a six-pointer tonight for Manchester United. If they win, they're 3 points behind. If they lose, they're 9 points behind fourth. And obviously fourth is very important at the moment. It might be fifth, but as people keep talking about, this appeal to cast might end up being what means top four is top four this year, and we'll see what happens. Right, Armit McCarthy's Ireland squad capable of playing with a back three. Here's Gary Breen's view of our options ahead of the Euro 2020 playoffs.
I would normally expect players at international level to be able to cope with being given a message and learning. Listen, there is enough time to work on it. He obviously doesn't believe that that squad of players is capable of it.
Now, I should add as well that he did say we tried against Switzerland and it didn't work. But that, you know, that game was just, it was going against us all the time.
This is not, Mick is not averse to playing a back five. I think when he initially got the job first time round, we started off with a back five to the extent that I was playing in a back three with Roy at centre-back in the middle of a three. I think that was in vogue at the time, where the dominant midfielders of Europe were playing deeper in that Beckenbauer role. So he will do it, but he'll look at the situation now. The only thing I will say is that if you think about the likes of Wolves, and notably it centres around Doherty, doesn't it, in terms of that right wing-back role, we don't have centre midfielders like Neves and Coutinho who look after the ball. That's the problem. Mm. It's all well and good being expansive and playing, but if your midfielders give the ball away as often as ours do, you're in trouble. I think what is interesting, and this is what I hope, as much as we're talking about certain players, I've been really impressed with how McCarthy has done at Palace. Now, I'm not sure what the situation is, whether or not he's ready to come back, but even in big games against Manchester City, he played in a three-man midfield, just to the left-hand side, and his role there, bearing in mind, up against Manchester City, and how devastating De Bruyne is at making those underlapping runs down that side. He was so disciplined, so good. It was impressive. So I'm sure Mick would have noted that. Whether or not James is ready to come back, I know Mick is a big fan of his. He tried to sign him from Scotland for Wolves initially, but he chose to go to Wigan. So listen, we want all the players who can potentially play to be fit and healthy. Mm. There's still a couple of weeks to go as such until that has happened, but fingers crossed that they all are.
8:34, let's bring you through the top five stories of the morning. The Manchester City saga, we're going to cover that a little bit later on with Sam Lee coming your way at 9 o'clock. We talked about it a little bit with Kenny Cunningham there. Chelsea-Manchester United again, it's a proper six-pointer. We talked about that with Kenny just a couple of minutes ago as well. The situation at Daily Mail we'll come back to in just a minute. Hello Magazine, this is the first time Hello Magazine has made our top five. That's because it features an off-the-ball member. No prizes for guessing who that is. And England-Ireland, the rugby build-up has begun in earnest ahead of a possible triple crown in the first season of the new management team. Where do you want to start, Owen?
We can start wherever. Like, we can just do a quick note on Manchester United against Chelsea tonight, or Chelsea against Manchester United. This is going to be Odion Ighalo's Manchester United debut, so he's kind of the centre of a couple of pieces in the newspapers today.
Is he starting?
No. He will come off the bench, though, according to what I'm reading here. So there's a couple of Telegraph pieces carried in the Indo this morning, and Oliver Brown is kind of focused on the Nigerian angle behind Ighalo, just kind of touching on how it is the Premier League's greatest untapped market. Like 80 million people, they estimate, to be tuning into the Premier League every week in these massive theatres of football, often in football stadiums around Nigeria, huge gatherings of people. So I think Nigeria will become a Manchester United country very temporarily. They were an Arsenal country for a while when Kanu was playing for them, for example. You've obviously had Yakubu, Babayaro, all these sort of players playing in the Premier League. But it is the first time a Nigerian will play for Manchester United, which I didn't know. I thought just naturally, given how big the country is and how many Nigerians have played in the Premier League, they would have been one before. But Ighalo is set to become the first Nigerian to play for them. So this is the angle that Oliver Brown has gone for, talking about creating an orphanage in his name in Lagos. He's hugely attached to his home country. And this is an element that I didn't actually realise, that this is a hugely satisfying moment for Ighalo in his career, getting to actually play for Manchester United in the end. Some people might have had their eyebrows raised, but it comes at the end of a very, very tough couple of months for him because, to quote this article, the happiness of his improbable United switch is tempered by the loss of his sister Mary, who died in December, aged just 43, after collapsing at her home. So it is her name that will be stitched in his red boots against Chelsea tonight alongside the Nigerian flag. So that's just one of the quick angles about tonight's game. The other thing, and this is a very small sentence that stuck out to me, it's from Frank Lampard's pre-match quotes. He said he looks at the league table two or three times a day sometimes, which is an interesting ratio. Do you not have better things to do with your time rather than...
No, I think...
Or maybe it's a constant reminder of what exactly the battle is.
Yeah, I mean, I read an introduction to a piece. Oh, managers say they never look at the league table until the end. That's bollocks. Who actually... What managers actually say that? I love those pieces of sports journalism where, oh, X says this, which, like, really? Did anybody make that argument? I don't think anybody made that argument. Somebody the weekend of the papers was like, oh, Ireland, we're going to win the World Cup after we beat Scotland. Literally nobody on the planet thought that Ireland were going to win the Rugby World Cup after we beat Scotland in that game. Literally nobody. Not even Joe Schmidt thought we were going to win the World Cup after we beat Scotland.
There might have been one or two people.
There was nobody. There was nobody. Find me a single human being of the 7.5 billion on this teeming infestation of life that is planet Earth. Find me one of those people who said, oh, we're going to win the World Cup. Publicly.
After we beat Scotland in Japan.
Yeah. Nobody. Nobody.
I vox popped a few people who really believed that we were going to win the World Cup.
At that point. Those clowns aside.
let's move on to Daily Mount. Dan McDonald's piece in the Irish Independent this morning. Derby falls victim to bad planning and wrath of the storm. So he's gone through all the different situations at play on Saturday afternoon. Obviously, it was Bowes up against Rovers. Like you can see in some of the pictures here in the article, you've got Niall Quinn, Roy Barrett, Pascal Donoghue all present. You had basically a situation where RTE couldn't broadcast the game because of bad weather. The game was initially supposed to be played on a Saturday night or on Friday night. Due to security concerns, it was going to be moved to the Saturday afternoon from the Friday night. Rovers ended up winning the game 1-0, but it was what happened after the game, really, which has caught most of the attention. You had Gary Gannon tweeting about scenes of fights, basically, around Phibsborough. Disgraceful scenes happening in Phibsborough at the minute, he tweeted. A full-on riot taking place between a horde of grown men under the guise of being football supporters. I'm not sure what procedures were in place, but no Gardaí were present outside the fire station just now while gangs of thugs fought in the middle of the street. Both Bowes and Rovers have made a huge contribution to the League of Ireland the past few years, and these men aren't supporters and do nothing to add to the league or what should be a great sporting occasion. Gobshites, says Gary Gannon. Video footage emerged of some of the scenes here in Phibsborough. This is from Darren Cleary at Radio Cleary, his Twitter account at the weekend. And this has obviously kind of sparked a fair bit of discussion. But Dan has some really interesting detail in this article. Basically, Bowes have a new security firm and they wanted time to adjust and explain this to the FAI. So the decision was made to switch the game to Saturday before the clubs could discuss it. And Bowes had concerns about having a new security firm to the point where their president, Chris Bryan, said his own club would have been okay with the game switching to Tala on a Friday night. So we don't know right now whether or not there was whether the game would have been safer or not on a Friday night. You can see why perhaps they wanted it to move to a Saturday afternoon, but essentially it turned into, you'd imagine, an early start in the pub perhaps or wherever, and like it's just ended up in a fairly bad look once again.
It's not just booze though. It's not like booze is kind of an excuse in a way. Like this,
true,
is,
I suppose,
this,
yeah. this seems behavior, yeah.
Yeah, and it almost seems orchestrated, like let's meet and do this thing as opposed to anything else. So look, I definitely you have to get to grips with the policing of it, and I think the guards are going to have to come out and answer some questions as well. Gary Gannon's point, where were the guards outside the fire station? That's not outside the fire station. The fire station's around the corner as far as I know, so that's down, that's in the Phibsborough Road, isn't it? Where the footage we've just seen, to kind of in between the back page and McGowan's, it looked like. I'm not entirely sure about that, but it seems as if there were a couple of different sources of this.
So
sites, rather.
The Gardaí, who I've been in touch with this morning, said they're investigating a public order incident that occurred in the Phibsborough area at approximately 5 p.m. reported that an altercation occurred between a large group of people. Members of the Garda Public Order Unit attended the scene, and a man aged in his 40s sustained head injuries and has been taken to the matter. The extent of those injuries are not known at this time, but they say they have obtained CCTV footage and are following a definite line of inquiry, and they're appealing for anyone with information to contact Mountjoy. Just one of the other, very briefly, last Mountjoy Garda station, I should say, one of the very last things that I want to point out from Dan's article, just two very striking lines. He says, Daly Mount is no longer a suitable venue to house a game between two of the best teams in Ireland. And he says facilities are holding the image of the game back. And then he points to the fact that you see these scenes between rival clubs in Dublin. You've got the possibility of German and England fans going toe-to-toe in the streets of Dublin very shortly. Like, it's only a possibility. It's not a fixture set in stone. Who knows if people will make the journey over here, but is this city equipped to handle these sort of scenes? It's certainly a question that probably needs to be raised.
Who pays for the policing? Why was there not enough policing? All that kind of stuff. These are the questions that need to be answered over the next while. And, like, the FAI obviously have a lot on their plate at the moment, but they also need to be seen to be addressing these issues. I think that would be very important. And then lastly, while the mood music seems positive from people in football in the south about the potential for a 32 county domestic league, this happens and you're like, okay, we actually need to have a proper conversation about what the level of policing would be around games involving teams. You know, it's not a great look for the opening weekend of the league, because stuff on the pitch, obviously, should have been the thing that we were talking about.
One more newspaper we want to get to this morning. Actually, I don't have it in front of me. I don't have the physical copy. We're going to have to rely. I will run out to the shop after the show to go and pick up Hello Magazine. Today's edition includes an exclusive.
Wow.
Dan's gonna ice couple, Brianne Delcour and Kevin Kilbane, share exciting wedding plans. You see that snowy landscape behind them? That is not
Preston.
Fake. That is real. That is Canada.
Wow.
Talking in detail about their wedding day for the first time. The couple tell how they will marry in Ireland, which is new, and Brianne has already chosen her wedding gown. She's quoted here saying, "Yes, I have found the dress and our heart is set on getting married in Ireland, and it will be so beautiful and it is special to Kevin." So Mayo think that they've got big things going for them in the past, like Rory McIlroy's wedding. It's about to get bigger because it looks like Kevin Kilbane is going to get married there. So he says, over the next month, we're going to... this is Kevin, by the way. "Over the next month, we are going there to introduce Brianne to my family and to look at venues. We are going to set a date for September or October. I like what he's done there. Possibility of Mayo being in All-Ireland in September.
Ooh.
In that case, it's going to be October. I would advise you not to pick the first Saturday or first Sunday in September. And actually, leave a bit of room for the replay as well. Leave about 2 weeks for the celebrations after Mayo win the All-Ireland. Go for the first weekend of October, I think." And they say top of their wish list will be County Mayo on the West Coast. Because, of course, they're explaining to Hello readers where Mayo is. I'm sure people at home watching ODBAM know where Mayo is.
Jimmy Bullard. Tommy Rooney.
Tommy Rooney. Need some style tips from you soon. This is...
this is his Instagram post from last night.
Yeah.
Here's a preview pick.
Great turtleneck. And what a jacket.
Of Brianne and I from our photo shoot from Canada. Gets full piece at Hello Mag tomorrow. Tommy Rooney's first one up. Need some style tips from you soon. At KD Kilbane 77. Yes, you do, Tommy. Tommy comes in with a jumper with the word Tommy across it sometimes and goes, "Oh shit, I got dressed in the dark this morning." Just in case he forgets his name. And then the last one there, stick that back up for us, is Jimmy Bullard. Ha ha ha, killer. Leave it out. When Jimmy Bullard is telling you to leave it out, Kev, something has gone remarkably well for you in life.
One last detail from the article, for people who are wondering, Kevin did get in touch with Brianne's father for his permission. "I couldn't tell you how the conversation went as I was so nervous," he says. "My heart was racing."
Old school, Kev. Right, the man who broke Villa Hearts, Son Heung-min, spoke to Nathan Murphy after his 94th minute winner yesterday afternoon.
How sweet a moment was that at the end?
No, I think it's unbelievable. Of course, winning is always a good way, but especially that way is make us even more happy, and we fight until from the start and till end. So glad to get 3 points here and then very happy.
You had a long way to bring the ball, a good 40 yards between the defender missing it, and it was a game where Tottenham missed a lot of chances. What was going through your head?
Yeah, I felt of course a little bit pressure because I have to run a long way and keep had a very good day and made unbelievable saves, and yeah, but I was very, very calm. I was very try to be calm and try to finish well. This is what I always try to doing, and but luckily the ball went inside, and I was so happy, and then see the celebration, the away fans, and yeah, I think it's just the timing, the celebration, I think was perfect.
A couple of games, the Manchester City match and this one, where maybe at times you rode your luck a little bit, but does that show the character that Mourinho has instilled, that this is a side that doesn't give up?
No, I think we saw some of games we turn it around, so I think, for example, Olympiacos, Norwich game, Southampton, and now I think it's all about character. I think I'm really happy to have this group, and I'm lucky to have this quarter playing with this team.
And obviously a huge week going to Stamford Bridge next Saturday, but first the Champions League. Do you think last season getting to the final has sort of given this side a knowledge of how to deal with these big Champions League nights?
It's a Champions League. We've been last season, we've been Champions League final, but it's already passed, but we don't think about it too much because our hand, we don't have anything at the moment, so we just want to focus game by game, try to be ready for not a big match, and yeah, we'll see what's going to happen. Of course, it's a big side and doing unbelievable job in Germany, so yeah, let's see. I'm very excited.
Well done today.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's right. It is a big game this week. We'll talk about that Champions League games tomorrow. Now that Tom Malone is here. Tom, how are you?
Yeah, good. Start with golf. Disappointing 2-over par final round of 73, so Rory McIlroy finished on 8-under par and a tie for 5th place at the Genesis Invitational overnight in the PGA Tour. The new world number one held a share of the lead going into the final round. It was eventually won by Australian Adam Scott on 11-under par. Let's move on to football, and Arsenal manager Mikel Arteta says he's not giving up hope of his side finishing in the Champions League qualifying places. Their 4-0 win against Newcastle yesterday means they're 7 points behind Chelsea, who are in 4th currently, but Manchester City's banned from the European club competitions next season. If that's upheld, qualification could extend to 5th place. Arteta says he'll just continue to focus on the next game.
Honestly, I'm just aiming about improving this process, performing better, playing better, and that will lead to results. And if we are able to sustain that, I'm convinced in the last 3 or 4 games of the season we're going to have a chance. If we don't do that, it doesn't matter if it's 4th or 5th, we have no chance.
Meanwhile, after that game, Ireland manager Mick McCarthy will have a nervous wait over the fitness of Newcastle defender Kieran Clark, who went off injured in the second half of that game. He left the ground on crutches, and Steve Bruce said at full time that it seemed serious and didn't look good, but that he will know more in the next 24 to 48 hours. Also in North London, Tottenham boss Jose Mourinho says they have a big fight to get into the Champions League places. Spurs up to 5th following their 3-2 win over Aston Villa yesterday. That may be good enough to qualify for the Champions League with Manchester City's punishment for breaching UEFA's fair play rules. But Mourinho says his side are not the only ones with European ambitions.
Wolves, Sheffield, Manchester United, Arsenal, Everton, everybody looks to the table, and week after week they say we can do it. And they can.
And ahead of tonight's game in the Premier League, as Chelsea welcome Manchester United to Stamford Bridge, some sad news that the former Manchester United and Northern Ireland goalkeeper Harry Craig, a hero of the Munich air disaster, has died at the age of 87. With that match tonight, of course, a big week for Frank Lampard and his side, who face rivals Tottenham on Saturday, then Bayern Munich in the Champions League as well during the week. United, of course, 4-0 winners the last time these two sides met on the opening day of the season. They have enjoyed different fortunes since, though, with Frank Lampard's side in 4th, while United down in 9th. And the Chelsea boss knows how important tonight could be to the campaign.
It's a game we want to win, you know, and of course, must not lose, I don't care how you put it. I agree that at home this season we haven't got what we want, sometimes what we deserve, but we haven't got what we want. That's a fact. So now we have 3 big home games to try and show that and put that right, exactly the right time.
That game kicks off in London at 8. Well, in Gaelic games, Cork sit 3rd in Group A of Division 1 of the Allianz National Hurling League this morning. There are 3-12 to 1-14 winners over Westmeath, who have yet to register a win in the competition. Clare are top of Group B after their 17-9 win over Eddie Brennan's Laois at Cusack Park. And Kilkenny continue to sit one place above Wexford on goal difference, despite David Fitzgerald's side getting the better of the Cats by 2 points yesterday in Wexford Park. That finished 116 to 114. While in ladies football, Mayo have 2 wins from 3 games in Division 1 of the Lidl Ladies National Football League. They beat Waterford by 6-2 in horrific conditions in Swinford yesterday. Tipperary, meanwhile, got their first win of the campaign, getting the better of Basement side Westmeath by 11-16 in Banshee. And finally, in rugby league, as it continues to shoot itself in the foot, the Super League is investigating after 2 spectators say they were told to remove rainbow flags during Israel Folau's debut for the Catalan Dragons. The 2 women said they were told to remove the flags, a symbol of LGBT pride, on health and safety grounds.
Oh, just open safety, innit?
Just rugby.
It's Europe, innit?
Oh my God, you want to
see... It's that EU, they want you to take that down.
You want to see the comments below that tweet. In the game itself, Israel Folau scored a try for his new side in the 36-18 win over Castleford, and the Catalans Dragon spokesman said after the game, rainbow flags are not banned, it is not forbidden, before adding, we are gathering more information.
Tiger Roll,
brilliant return to the track yesterday. Right. Finished fifth, ran keen the whole way, just tied up a little bit in the closing stages. Absolutely perfect prep run.
Because before this, there was a bit of concern. He wasn't as fit as he would have been
as fit as he was this time last year. He had one more run last year. He actually ran in Cheltenham in a prep race before Christmas last year. So he'd only, Gordon Elliott said after the race, he only started cantering on the 1st of January. So, I mean, to get from there today and get a run into him is spectacular. I'll actually be down to Gordon Elliott tomorrow morning, so some stuff from him. So.
Right, well, we'll talk to you then.
Yeah.
Good stuff, Tom. Thanks for that. 8:52 this morning. Alan Quinlan joins us next in studio here to talk rugby. On Friday, I popped out to Leinster Rugby for a chat with Stuart Lancaster, a full hour-long in-depth conversation with him about loads of different stuff. Here we are. You can get that on our YouTube channel or on our podcast network, by the way. Here's Stuart talking about the importance of identity in Irish provincial rugby.
Lads who are born and bred in Leinster and Dublin and, you know, come here, they want to put a blue shirt on. And in the same way that lads in Munster, you know, they want to put a red shirt on.
So if there was a system where players were drafted out or whatever, you know, these conversations are happening in the ether, and the main risk, as you would see it, would be the dilution of the rivalries.
The dilution of identity. And I think, you know, identity in a team, you know, is critical. You know, you have to play for a cause. You have to play for something and someone and some area or some province, you know. I think you dilute the identity of the team, of any team, if you were to do that. It's not the only thing that makes a team, but if I look at teams in England by comparison, you know, London Irish, for example, they've got some good young players come through the academy, but a lot of their players are overseas or not from the catchment area of London Irish. You know, I compare that to, say, Leinster, where 95% of our talent is from Leinster. Mm. And then you throw in, you know, a Scott Fardy and a James Lowe and one or two others. That's the model.
That's the model, according to Stuart Lancaster. Very briefly, Alan, we'll talk about that before we get to everything else. The identity of the provinces is very important. We've talked about this ad nauseum now. If you start transferring players, suddenly identity starts becoming a bit diluted. The proper solution for the other provinces not producing enough players is to invest massively in the club game and in the underage game in Munster, in Connacht and in Ulster. Not to just say, OK, we're going to punish Leinster for producing all these great players and redistribute the wealth. It's to spend loads of the IRFU's money on hiring coaches at underage level and build a structure for the future.
Yeah, for sure. But the problem with that, Ger, is if you take a step back for a couple of years and the team drops, it has a double effect. You lose money. So the ideal scenario is for Munster, Ulster, Connacht to try and do that as best they can with the help of the IRFU, but also try and stay competitive. And that's probably where the frustration probably comes from when people talk about Munster and the identity and outside players coming in, playing too many of them at times, and that's where that issue is. It's, to be fair, Stuart has been incredible, and I have massive respect for him, but for Leinster, what they've created now is much more sustainable because of the systems they have in place through the school systems. It helps them a lot.
Absolutely.
So you can't just go and say, but I do agree with you to a point, and this is going right down to the grassroots level in the other provinces, is train the coaches, get better development for young players. And we hear it about the Southern Hemisphere so often, about the natural skill and ability that they get from really good coaching from underage. It goes right back to a club, 7 or 8 year old playing with a club or in whatever province. What kind of coaching are they getting as they grow up along? And a lot of times it's parents, because the people aren't there in the club to do it.
The model for me is not, the model that I think the other three provinces, and maybe Ulster's a bit different because they do have a school tradition, but is not to ape what Leinster are doing, it's to ape what Dublin GAA are doing. Yeah. They're spending money on coaches to get into the schools.
But to be fair,
and the IRFU have loads of money, so don't let them say we can't afford to do it.
Going right back to the coaching courses and training coaches, that's been going on for years, where the coaches have to get
how much money are they spending
accredited
on it?
It does. I went on coaching courses when I was young. All the guys in my club in Clanwilliam the coaches there would go on the coaching courses. But there is a point that I get. that if you can get top quality guys going around to the clubs, and the fundamentals and the structures are there, it probably just needs to be invested more and more and more.
Flood those
and
money.
In an ideal world, I guarantee you, talk to anyone invested in Munster rugby, they'd love that conveyor belt of players coming through. And I think there has been a significant shift and change in that policy and that mentality in Munster about trying to develop more younger players and really putting a massive ownership and emphasis on it around their academy.
Yeah.
And the money that they actually did. You know, Munster have a commercial board, and a lot of their fundraising and their contribution is to the Green Core Academy.
And now look,
to try and develop that.
And I think that's great, but the IRFU should be spending all that money,
yeah.
I think.
I think they do invest a lot now, Ger. I agree with you.
I just think it should be more. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, looking at it currently, when you think of the other provinces are much more need of that scenario than probably Leinster at the moment. But
yeah, the Leinster system works, but I'm just making the point, trying to ape it.
Split Leinster in two.
Well, look,
split Dublin in two.
I mean, that conversation is going to start happening at some level in
the
next while.
You look at the Backross situation. So I was going to talk about, obviously, the weekend. We've man of the matches in the Backross of John Hodnett, who's a really exciting prospect in Munster, and Will Connors, very similar in stature. They're very, very alike.
What are they both like? Tell us, because people won't know
them. They're just abrasive and aggressive and quick.
Where do they play?
Full of energy. They're both playing seven.
Right.
Hodnett was really impressive for Ireland, and I think he probably would have had more involvement at this stage with Munster, only for picking up an injury after that World Cup last year and getting a shoulder operation. So if I'm correct, I think it was a shoulder operation, but he was injured for a number of months. But he made his debut on Friday night. He was really good. The Kings were poor. The Southern Kings were really poor. Munster won comprehensively. But Will Connors is a bit more advanced in his development because he's had more game time, and he's been sensational for Leinster. And you talk about the amount of players they have. When Jack Conan comes back and Dan Levy, the amount of back rows that Leinster are going to have. And they're going to have this situation again where who stays, who goes, and what players feel, where they feel they can fit in and get on the team, because they're top quality players right across the board.
Connors is 23, turning 24 in April, so he's not young.
He's not young, but I think he's made his kind of breakthrough this year and really grabbed the attention, and he's had a number of man of the match performances. And
is he an out and out seven?
He's someone who can play six as well, I'd say.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. But he's hard and he's quick and he's aggressive and really powerful in the carry again. So it's unbelievable, you know, the amount of players that they have and young players coming through.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a problem for Leinster. You know, their identity that you're talking about, that Stuart Lancaster's talking about, they have that ability to select from all these homegrown players because they're coming through all the time.
Connors turned down the opportunity to move to Connacht towards the end of the 2017-2018 season, and who knows, maybe his career is further advanced, but maybe getting that quality of coaching that he's had at Leinster is going to turn him into a player who, when he's 26, 27, 28, is our best number seven.
So yeah, who knows. And Levy's back running, which is fantastic to hear as well. And I think for none of them will want to leave now. That's the problem. How do you facilitate all those players? And that's the issue. And some of them will be, I know they can't be forced, but the other provinces, Connacht would gladly take any of those back rowers at this stage. They had a brilliant win at the weekend, I think, which kind of puts them back on track a little bit. There were a couple of points, only a point ahead of Cardiff going into that game. So they're in fourth place now. To win 29-0 against the Cardiff Blues, I think, was very impressive in really, really windy conditions. They badly needed it because they've been on a poor run of late. Now, they had tough European games as well, but Connacht were really good at the weekend.
It seems that the best thing to do is just stay put, because somebody will get injured. Like, if you look at the Geordie Murphy situation, he made his move to Ulster before the conclusion of that year's Champions Cup, ends up starting the Champions Cup final, that he couldn't have foreseen what would have happened a couple of weeks later than that. It's almost like a situation now that that's a sign for the Leinster players to stay put. You will get your chance eventually, because obviously it's such an abrasive position in the back row.
It is, yeah. And I remember back to my time at Munster, David Wallace was a British and Irish line in 2001, and at the start of the next season in September, he was playing for Gary Owen. It's incredible how it can change very quickly. So I don't know how they're going to facilitate so many of them there, and I'm sure there's more younger players coming through who will fancy their chances, good back rows in Leinster. I don't know what I'd do as a player myself. I think you would certainly try and back yourself to stay and get selected. I think in a sense you don't get dropped anymore unless it's the big European quarter-final, semi-final or final. It's rotation week after week, so it's not back then. Back when I played, you were dropped and it was like devastating and you weren't selected, and the perception around that. Now, guys, there's so much change. Your reputation is not damaged if you don't play. But ultimately, when Leinster pick a back row for a Heineken Cup semi-final or Heineken Cup final, that's when three or four got down the pecking order. If you're sitting down there somewhere and you've been training with Ireland, or you've been close to Ireland, or you've been getting Man of the Match awards during the season,
then you need to think about it.
You know, it's a tough one for players to take, and they have that luxury at the moment.
We're playing England this weekend, obviously. A triple crown on the line, a big opportunity for Andy Farrell to achieve something in his first season as head coach. It certainly seems as if we're a differently set up team under Andy Farrell, and it's going to be interesting to see how we set up this week. And it looks like Jerry Thorney says no changes really, apart from Caelan Doris on the bench. What do you expect from Eddie Jones? A few grenades this week?
I'm not sure. I think he was. He started speaking last week about how he respects Ireland, how good they are and stuff. He hasn't thrown any barbs in yet. He did it for France, talking about the brutality and about the French players wouldn't be able to live with that, and it kind of backfired on him. There was a bit of talk around the Scottish game as well from some of the English players, which was surprising how they hate us, we hate them, and you know, from some of their inexperienced players as such. So I used to think when Eddie Jones spoke about Johnny Sexton a number of years ago and his safety and all that stuff and his parents should be worried, I thought he crossed the line there, and you know, it backfired him then at the World Cup a bit, with Warren Gatlin said that you know, sometimes teams play their best performance in a semi-final, and
ultimately
he was right, and he kind of laughed and sneered at him. I actually, after getting to know him a bit, I think he's definitely a decent fella who just loves stirring the pot a little bit. And when you kind of understand that, you think last year, 12 months ago, John Mitchell was literally told, go out and talk about Ireland, and he spoke about Ireland, they'll bore you to tears.
And then they smashed us.
Yeah, they did. And it's those psychological little kind of things. He's trying to put doubt, and he's more or less admitted that. And he was asked after the Scottish game why he does that, and he says he admitted it's to try and create a little bit of uncertainty in the opposition camp. So I don't think it's going to have any effect no matter what he says this week. He'll maybe question Ireland's mentality and that they are brittle after the World Cup, and that, or else he'll tell them they're the best team in the world now and that they're great. And
well, when we won the Grand Slam over there, they had no Tuilagi and no Vunipola at eight.
Billy Vunipola, yeah.
It's going to be the same situation this weekend.
Yeah, I'm not sure, 100% sure on Tuilagi. I'd be amazed if he plays.
They're a far more beatable team when we play them, when they don't have
If you take Billy Vunipola out of the Saracens team or the England team, it is different. He just gives him a real focal point of attack. He every time he carries, it takes a couple of guys to stop him, sucks people in. And Tuilagi, pretty similar in the centre. So they are a different team. They're still a very powerful team. And I think the key this week is for Ireland, I've said it a couple of times, and I suppose I'm over egging the point at times, it's just that intensity that Ireland bring. Doing that game 2 years ago, commentating on it, just the intensity and the pace that Ireland were doing stuff at, it was so hard the way they started the game. England just couldn't get the ball back off them, and they were so efficient in everything they did. So getting up to that level I don't think it's too early to get any risk carried away, because look, the first two games were games I probably before the tournament started, I thought we'd win. After we beat Scotland, laboured, I was nervous about Wales. So effectively, the real test is Sunday in Twickenham, and it'll be interesting to see if Eddie Jones starts talking about what he says during the week.
Yeah, I expect some of it. Alan, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. Right, it is 9:05. We're talking about Manchester City next with Sam Lee of The Athletic. What's going to happen? We'll find out next. OTB AM. Okay, let's turn our attention to the situation at Manchester City. And Sam Lee of The Athletic joins us this morning. Sam, good morning to you. How are you doing?
Good morning. Yeah, not bad, thanks. Busy weekend.
I can only imagine late Friday night is the perfect time to release these type of stories because, you know, it gives everybody plenty of time to think about it all weekend and talk about it on Sunday. What do you expect to happen next? And what are the routes available to Manchester City to appeal this properly?
Okay, yeah. So what I expect to happen, and I think this is pretty obvious from City's statement on Friday night, is they're going to appeal it. They could go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. I think they're most likely going to say or go down the route of abuse of process and say that UEFA's process was flawed and maybe prejudiced. They've already tried that. They went to CAS before there was even a decision to appeal against, which got thrown out ultimately because CAS said, well, there's no appeal, so what are you doing coming to us? But some of the things they said about the leaks through the process, CAS said, OK, you may have a point in there. So that might be something that you go back to. I think they're also ready to say, well, look at these guys and look at these guys and look at these guys. But the only thing with that is that's not really absolving themselves. It's kind of dragging everyone else down with them. So they might be able to get PSG or Juventus or Bayern Munich in the dock as well, but I can't see them overturning it. So basically they need to prove their own innocence and they will go to CAS to do that. If CAS side with UEFA, they may even go to the Swiss courts beyond that. And that then could be something that goes on for years. And they may even have to serve that Champions League ban while trying to fight and clear their name in European courts for years to come.
Okay, that's interesting because no one was quite exactly sure how that whole process would work. So just to recap, there's the technical grounds in which they might try and get this thrown out, and then there's the everybody else was doing it. Neither of which is like, we're not guilty here. It's more we're getting off on a legal technicality.
Well, yeah, exactly. But I mean, in fairness, in the City statement and all the statements they put out, they've always said there's no evidence for their wrongdoing and that they'd be able to prove that. So I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing, I'm sure everyone is, you know, is that true? You know, do they think they will get this overturned? Because they're supremely confident that they will. But do they think they'll get it overturned because they can prove that UEFA's process was a little bit dodgy or because they actually haven't done anything? And the emails that are in Der Spiegel and other publications from football leagues, they always say they were taken out of context. We haven't actually seen the context. Now, if Man City were to say, these are all the emails, here's the context, we might be able to go, oh, yeah, there is a campaign against the club. But we haven't seen that yet. So, yeah, what they need to actually do is prove that they haven't done anything wrong. If it gets overturned because the process was dodgy, that will be a fair a judgment from CAS, I think. But, you know, in the court of public opinion, nobody's going to say, oh, yeah, City were hard done by. They're going to say, well, they still did wrong. They've just been able to prove that UEFA did wrong as well. It's a bit of a complicated one, really.
It would be quite
very complicated, obviously.
It would be quite the power play from UEFA that if their process was dodgy, to still go ahead and actually ban Manchester City from UEFA competition for two seasons. You would imagine that they are fairly watertight in their process if they are going to make this decision, because it is a landmark decision, Sam. I don't think many people actually expected them to have the courage to go ahead and do this.
No, they didn't. There was a lot of shock around it. And I think even, you know, people who wanted it to happen and have been following it closely, I think they were sceptical whether UEFA were going to act quite so much. I didn't expect anything near as severe. There are a few theories floating around that, you know, it might just be a way, you know, for UEFA to look strong and say, look, this is what we actually wanted. This is what we handed them with. But then for UEFA to kind of not exactly have the best process for it, and it eventually gets overturned by CAS, and UEFA can say, well, we did everything we wanted. We did everything we said we would, but ultimately City fought it and they've used their financial might instead of our justice or whatever. So it might be a way for everyone to kind of win. You know, City may get off with it, but UEFA could still look strong. It's part of it. It could be that element, really.
What has Pep Guardiola's reaction been? I think there was a meeting between himself and the players on Saturday.
Yeah, well, there was always going to be a meeting because they were on their winter break and they were going to have a training session on Saturday. So they always would have had a meeting about these are the games you've got coming up. And, you know, if you're not feeling ready, you're going to have a massage or whatever. But obviously now, given what happened on Friday night, it took on a bit of greater significance. And it was peak Guardiola, really, by all accounts. You know, he told them, you know, not... Yeah, it's tempting to say siege mentality, but it was kind of, if they don't believe in us, you know, we'll show them, and, you know, we need to go and show people that we haven't just won what we've won because of money, we've done it because we're good, you know, we're good players, good managers. And the rest of it was quite literally, I focus on the next game. The next game in this case seems to be, you know, they're thinking ahead to Real Madrid, but they're using the rearranged West Ham game and the Leicester game as the build-up to the first leg of the Champions League game against Real Madrid. And the idea is, be as focused as you ever have been. Don't go to any parties. Don't do any events. Eat well. Look after yourself. Sleep well. Make sure you're focused and ready on the Real Madrid game. So that's what Guardiola's response has been.
Sam, the comments from Steven Gerrard over the weekend were, I thought, wild, to be honest, where he was saying he's very, very interested for obvious reasons, planting the notion that somehow the Premier League are going to step in and strip Manchester City of titles that have been won. Mm. There's no possibility of that, surely, is there?
Well, I mean, all I can say really on the Premier League front is there is a possibility of points deductions, but we don't know if they would be historic or whether they would just say, oh, well, we found you guilty now, so here's the points deduction now. The Premier League have always been pretty tight-lipped on this. It's an interesting one because it always seemed like the Premier League would just kind of follow any UEFA's lead a little bit in the sense of, OK, well, there's an investigation, so we probably had better investigate as well. Their burden for losses, you know, for UEFA financial fair play, it's €30 million over 3 years. I think the Premier League allow for losses of €100 million in the season, £100 million even. But it's just whether they decide that they've been misled or whether they've, you know, cooked the books effectively, inflated these sponsorships. If they do, and maybe the Premier League now feel, OK, well, UEFA have got really strong, we need to get really strong as well, then there could well be a points deduction. But I mean, I'm sure you can imagine the legal minefield that they themselves have to go through if they went for it applies to this. But I mean, I suppose it's possible. I couldn't tell you for sure because this is what the Premier League would have to decide. But I suppose it's possible if they decided that City had broken the rules between 2012 and 2016, maybe they would look at those seasons and take points from all of those seasons. And then obviously in 2014, when they won the title, just about, if they were to take 5 points off, that would be enough for Liverpool. But I mean, can you imagine? Can you imagine, you know, the legal difficulties that would bring? You know, City are going to take you away for all the way. If the Premier League started taking titles off them, it would go on forever.
Is there any prospect of all of these legal difficulties and the backlash against the ownership of Manchester City? Is there any prospect of the ownership deciding that this is no longer worth the hassle, that the point of owning Manchester City was supposed to be to show an entire nation state in its best possible light, and now the ownership group have been found by UEFA not to have been running things properly, that there's a contagion towards their reputation that might ultimately lead to them deciding to step away from football?
Well, yeah, a colleague was saying over the weekend, you know, this will play badly in the region around Abu Dhabi, because the first time with the Champions League stuff, they could say, well, you know, it's definitions of earnings, and, you know, they moved the goalposts a bit, and, you know, we were compliant, and suddenly they changed this. It's, you know, it's all just that kind of stuff. But now, you know, this ban relates to, you know, deliberately misleading people, deceit and all this kind of stuff, and that will apparently not look so good. And as you say, if the goal of the ownership was to, you know, bask in the glory of a Premier League team and say, well, look, we're part of this wonderful football club that wins trophies and, you know, has got the best manager in the world and some of the best players. Yeah, they're not able to bask in that glory so much right now, are they? At the moment, I don't think there's any, well, it's very difficult to have a source inside the Abu Dhabi, you know, tourism arm. But at the moment, it doesn't seem like there's any sense that they're ready to pull out. It does seem that they're ready to fight it all the way. By all accounts, the Sheikh himself is very annoyed at it. They place a lot of the blame on PSG's shoulders. Obviously, you've got regional politics there with Qatar and Abu Dhabi. I think they're in the mood for a battle, really. If it gets to the end, and if they exhaust 10 years in the courts and they're still no better off, perhaps they'll pull out.
Players-wise, then, I guess the same question could be asked if they feel their own reputation is going to be hampered by this over the next couple of weeks, months or years. But then also there is the knock-on effect of if this ban is implemented, even if it is for one season, Sam, because first of all, they're not going to have the revenues from Champions League. But second of all, they're going to have to be doubly careful this time around to not funnel money from elsewhere into transfer policy. It will have to come from very proper procedure. So there might be an air of overcaution on the part of Manchester City, which would lead to all these signings that Pep Guardiola is looking to make. That'll make them redundant. They won't happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, for argument's sake, you know, City were pulled up on this because of the leaks from football leagues. You know, the emails. And if they're confident, they're not going to get an email. And if what UEFA is saying is true, then City have basically emailed around themselves and said, well, we can get sponsorship from wherever we want, it doesn't matter. If they feel they're not going to get caught again, if they feel their emails aren't going to get hacked, if what UEFA's saying is true, and it may well be, they may well be able to prove that, City may well feel, well, we'll just get the sponsorship back from someone else again, and it doesn't matter because they may just feel, well, they're not going to catch us this time. And if they do, well, we're just going to prove it again. So, there is that element of it. If what they say about City is true, then what's to say they will clean up their act now? On the other hand, from City, you mentioned the players. I think, I've heard of a couple of players, and I think there was a story overnight that Raheem Sterling is definitely going to be staying. That's come from his agent on the record, which is very rare in football media circles, certainly. A couple of others, maybe. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if some thought, not sure about this, need to be playing the Champions League, need to be, in line to win Ballon d'Ors or whatever, need to be at the top level ahead of the next World Cup, all this kind of stuff. As you say, it goes back to the revenues. City made a £10 million profit last year, which is all right as far as the football club's concerned, but you take out the £77 million they made from the Champions League, not including gate receipts. I think with gate receipts, it's probably closer to £90, £100 million. If that's the simple maths, then all of a sudden you're making a massive loss. And then if you're making a massive loss, you're going to fail financial fair play for the next time you want to get into the Champions League. So you're right, it might not come down to the players wanting to go. It might come down to the fact that you go, we need to sell Leroy Sané and not replace him. Or maybe we need to sell somebody else and not replace him, because we need to balance the books this way. So it might not be down to the players wanting out. It might be down to City saying, we need to balance the books. But of course, this all hinges on all these appeals that we're going to see in the next couple of months.
Yeah, if only they had a world-renowned academy that they could stock the team with, eh? Sam, great stuff. Thanks a million for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Pat.
That's Sam Lee there from The Athletic, who's been covering this story in great detail and great depth. You should check that out if you can. Now, global endurance athlete and Donegal man Jason Black is going to join us in studio next this morning here on OTBM. He's a man with a remarkable story. He's aiming to become the first person to ever complete the world's big three, the world's toughest human power challenge. The rules are simple. Solo race across America, solo row the Atlantic Ocean, and solo summit Mount Everest. Have a look.
The world's ultimate trilogy has never been achieved in the history of human existence. The three dramatic arts are bold, mythical, and magical. Life is an expedition, sometimes a battle full of the unexpected. Sometimes we focus on the destination and forget about the journey. But when you fall, life allows you to get up stronger. It allows you to trust in your own understanding, dream bigger, believe in yourself, and find real purpose. My name is Jason Black, and I'm an Irish Red Cross ambassador. The rules are simple. Solo summit Mount Everest, solo race across America, solo row the Atlantic Ocean.
Jason, good morning to you.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Great, thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Which stage of this are you at the moment? You've obviously done Everest.
Yeah, so nailed Everest in 2013 on the north side, and incredible experience, just mind-blowing, to be totally honest. As a young boy growing up in Donegal here in Ireland, never thought I could ever realise that. And so then just all ready to go now, 16th of June, Oceanside, California, 5,000 kilometres, race over to Maryland in the east coast of America. So plan of attack is 9 days, 22 hours on the bike, 2 hours off, 1 hour sleep, 1 hour to eat.
9 days?
9 days.
Right. How do you prepare for that?
Started out in Ireland as a young amateur cyclist, raced the Irish cycling scene as a road racer. Found out I was getting slower as my age went on, couldn't race the young guys any longer. Decided I had to shift my goals to the endurance world, fell in love with it completely, loved the whole character of it, loved the individuals within it, loved the whole motivation behind it. And I suppose a life on a bike in Ireland and Donegal and in the mountains and in the rivers, and just been blessed to have been in the great outdoors all my life, has kind of prepared me for this physically and, more importantly, mentally. And it's just marvellous to be able to do it.
So that's the macro, spiritual, yeah. That's how you get. But how do you physically prepare to cycle from California to Maryland?
Yeah, so it's like everything, I mean, it is that psychological battle. You start your first 5K and then you end up running a marathon. It's quite similar in the endurance world. The limiting factors are ourself. We think, I started out as a road racer and the maximum distance I would have raced was 150 kilometres. And I thought that was huge. Then you start looking at 500 and you think, and then, it's like a line in the sand. Once you do it, that's it. you've crossed it. You're never, you don't fear it again. And life's exactly the same. And then I moved to my first 1,000. 2,500 that was in the studio last year. And that next day I left to do my first 2,500 kilometre race. It was fantastic. Finished third. It was right around the circumference of Ireland. You know, that was just a magical moment for me because it just galvanised the fact that I had it inside to go further. And there was a lot of good things and bad things that happened. So the whole learning was incredible. And then I went on the 1st of August to the North Cape, which was 4,300 kilometres from Turin in Italy to the edge of the earth in Norway. And it was an unsupported race. I mean, find your food, find your water, and it's up to you whether you want to sleep or not. And travelling through 10 countries, dealing with different languages, dealing with different currencies. And it was brilliant. It was just class, you know what I mean? I come out of that really strong, finished sixth. I had a crash, ended up having to go to hospital. That kind of helped me back slightly. But that's all part of the journey. It was about that falling down and having the courage to get back up and get back on the bike, like life, which I keep referring to a lot, you know, because I speak to young kids about that. Don't be afraid to fall, but have the courage to get back up and on the saddle again. And for me, that once I came away from the North Cape, 4,500 in the bag, I knew that inside the body, that Race Across America, which is the blue ribbon for the endurance world, I knew that was possible. And they gave me an entry, and so now I'm going to be at the line on 16th of June. My start time is 12 o'clock, and I'm going to fly that Irish flag really proudly, you know, and I'm going to show that through endurance we can conquer everything and anything. And it's not about the bike. It's actually not about the sport. It's more about the process inside it. And that's really where the magic lies. And that's my message to each and everybody that I have an opportunity to share with, and for those that wish to listen, because not everybody's ready to listen to that story.
How come you realised it was possible, Jason? What did you learn about yourself that you thought to yourself, right, OK, now I'm ready?
Yeah, look, that's a brilliant question. You know, it's just that, you know, the ability to fall seven times but get up eight, and just to trust that inner ability. You know, it's just, you know, age is a great, it's a great learning curve as well. You know, when I was younger, I probably would never, even though I was probably fitter, I was certainly not stronger, but I was fitter mentally. I'm stronger today than I was physically back then, or than I am now than I was back then. So age has been a great learning for me, and through time and through the setbacks in life and through having a mortgage, experiencing death. And this is all off the bike. And I know the question you're asking is, you know, is it not about going out and doing 1,000 kilometres every week on a bicycle? Yes, that's part of it. There's the physical preparation, which we all can do. And the limiting factor for most people that choose not to take something on like this is the mental battle that's involved. And it's, you know, when you're at the start line of a race and you know that it's 3,000 kilometres to that finish line, how do you prepare yourself? But I don't look any further, and I mean this honestly, I don't look any further than the first kilometre. If I was to look at the 3,000 or 5,000 in America in June, I'd go bananas. So would anybody. I can only look about the next kilometre, and that's the same step. It's just that having the commitment to keep going forward. But it's great, like, you know, it is about involving yourself in races throughout the world. You know, as an endurance athlete, you know, I'd done the race across Laos, Thailand, Cambodia. I won that last year, and then I went into the race across Ireland. I went to the North Cape. I went to Oman and raced across the desert. And you're putting yourself in extreme environments, not extreme situations, extreme environments where there's very little around you other than your own ability to survive and believe in yourself. And it's only through that experience that the magic flows. It's only when you put yourself in that environment that you really get an opportunity to see the good, the bad and the ugly. And then it's through the good and the bad and the ugly you sieve through it to make yourself better.
You said there about 2 minutes ago you experienced death. Mm. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, so look, you know, I was doing a race there in September. I was delighted to be invited out to Eco Challenge in Fiji. It's deemed as one of the toughest endurance races in the world. It's 9 days through Fiji, 9 different disciplines, from whitewater rafting, deep sea diving, mountain biking, running, and everything else that's unsupported. Bear Grylls set the course. 66 countries were in there. And it was the most incredible journey. It was absolutely unbelievable. Outside of the culture and the experience of the people that we met, the race itself was just, you know, at a huge different level completely on an international stage. Sadly for me, on the last day, I picked up something in the jungle, because we're wading up to our waist in water, and we're going through different, you know, environments that are probably murky and are carrying some feces of some sort. And I picked up something. I came in through a cut in my leg that I had picked up an earlier on through rocks.
That's the cut there, I think, is it?
And that's it. And for me, you know, I just, my blood pressure dropped. The doctors and the medics got a hold of me and found out that they could do nothing for me in Fiji. It was kind of a red alert job, and sent for an airplane. Airlifted me to New Zealand. I crashed mid-flight. They had to resuscitate me. Whatever it was, it just attacked my internal organs, my kidneys, my lungs, my heart, all that kind of was really struggling hugely. And I don't remember any of that. I remember waking up in New Zealand. I was taken to a disease clinic. And it sounds a bit mad, but the doctors were delighted to have found this new bug that they had never witnessed and seen before. So they had to grow the cultures in the lab. And 8 days later, I was back on my feet again. And thanks to the incredible medical services globally, I'm here to tell the tale. So it's just another battle on the journey of endurance.
So you died? You were clinically dead for...
Mid-flight, yeah. Don't remember a thing.
Right.
And there were two French doctors on board, and they had the gear on board to shock me.
Right.
Bring me back. And I was talking to them 5 minutes before it.
So, I mean, obviously you weren't well. You were obviously very, very sick.
I was very sick, yeah. No question about it. Because in Fiji, and we were in the hospital there, they were sixes and sevens. Fabulous people, great doctors, but just didn't have the expertise to deal with the rare bug that had got inside. And there was sepsis in there. There was things flowing through my blood. And it's just a very unfortunate situation. But, you know, it's the challenges we face when we put ourselves in that environment.
What's your initial emotion when you come back to life, when you realise what's just happened?
I didn't, first of all, know what happened until they explained it to me. So, you know, you do have that opportunity then on your own, because you're back in the mountains in Donegal or back in Ireland here, or you're back in your bike and you're doing long hours. And you have that opportunity to reflect on, wow, that's close. Do I dwell on it? No, I don't. You know, do I accept the status quo? Yes, I do. I suppose I put myself in harm's way. You don't ever step into the arena for that to happen, but you do know that there's things like that can happen. So I don't really dwell too much on it, to be honest. It's just a part and parcel of the jigsaw puzzle.
We're going to see that story on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, so, Eco Challenge is quite special. You know, there were 66 countries, and to be an Irish athlete on that was just phenomenal. You know, Bear said it was going to be the most horrific and aggressive course that they've ever built, and it was. It was day and night, non-stop for 9 days, and it was magical. And Amazon Prime are putting it out now for 10 one-hour shows now from June on. But tonight, Special Forces goes out, and I'm here this morning to talk about that, and just to empower young people to watch the show. And through actions of 28 incredible people, the highs and lows, the good, the bad and the ugly, through endurance you can conquer again.
Special Forces is the course that the Irish Rangers do, is that right? Is it the exact same course? Is it modelled on the course?
It's modelled on the course. I would say, to be honest, it's watered down, if I'm completely honest, even though it was so incredibly tough. I mean, it really was. It's not a TV show, far from it. You know, the minute you get off that bus, the four Rangers get at you, and it is just, you know, you enter a bubble, and it's just like my adrenaline. And I have been used to this world quite a bit, but my adrenaline was so high for 2 days. It was just, I couldn't get it under control, because they keep you at an all-time high. You don't know when they're going to come in. They don't know what they expect from you. The drills are just non-stop, 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 non-stop. And it's the physical battle, but more importantly, it's the mental battle, the psychological battle. And there was 28 candidates from Ireland, ladies and gents, and the most fabulous people. And I can't speak about it highly enough. I can't praise the Irish Rangers enough myself personally, because I had no real experience of what an Irish Ranger goes through, or anybody in the Special Forces. But now having a snapshot, just a small snapshot of what it looks like, if that's even a quarter of what these guys do, hats off.
Most of the Rangers, as far as I know, fail at least once before they actually manage to make it through. And the level of failure is, the failure rate is so high.
Yeah, 95%.
Is it that high?
Yes.
Okay.
And very few of them get through the first time. I mean, the DSs are, you know, outside of the production, which you only got an opportunity to see them once when they bowed you out, you got to see that there was a human side to them. But outside of that, they are just killers, cutthroat, unbelievable. And they're, you know, they're a protecting force. And proudly, I mean, it's incredible what these guys go through. But the course itself was just unbelievable. It really was. It was everything.
What kind of physical challenge? And what is the physical challenge and what is the mental challenge?
Well, you're going to see it all tonight. You're not going to see it all tonight. It's one of seven series, an hour every Monday at 9:30. And each week they're trying to, or each exercise they're trying to eliminate candidates. Now, in particular, this year seemed to be extremely strong. There was absolutely 28 superstar athletes in there. And they said themselves they found it really hard to crack people. People did crack as they went along, and you were cracked on the most simplest things. Like, it was like sleep deprivation. You'd be put to bed at 11 o'clock, you think you're going to get a night's sleep, and 5 minutes later they have you up. And they have you up and they have you going for 10 hours, non-stop, in the mountains, in the rivers, pulling trucks, in the beach, doing the most outrageous exercises in the water. And just, you're completely and constantly be brought out of your comfort zone. And that in itself is the journey. It's not the exercises most people can do, but it's operating outside of your comfort zone on a continuous basis is where they get you. And then they break you. Well, when I say break you, it's not physically breaking you. They get you to surrender and say, that's it, I've had enough.
How come you don't surrender?
Well, I am. I'm human. I'm like everybody else. The show will show all. But, you know, sometimes I suppose through the journey of life and through the journey of endurance, you know, I've had more unsuccessful results in some races than I've had results. I mean, K2 in 2015, I didn't get to the summit. I walked away. I thought my chances were over. I rebuilt myself, went back in 2018, pulled it off. And it's that ability to go back in and do it. I do suffer, like I'm human like everybody else. I do suffer with the reality of defeat or a setback where I have to step back from the situation. I haven't completed it and I've got to rebuild myself and go forward. And, you know, that's something that's really important to me. It's, you know, accepting my limiting belief at that, or my limiting factor physically or mentally at the time, but having the ability just to get back up and say, right, what did I do right? What did I do wrong? How can I correct this? How can I make me stronger or fitter or faster? Was it physical? Was it mental? And then having the courage to. And I think sometimes that's the weak link, is that people, whether it's through life or through a marriage or through a work situation or through a sporting situation, when they have a setback, they blame everybody around us, and it's the blame culture. We absolutely blame everybody, but have the courage to look in the mirror and say, did I contribute to that? Was I not strong enough going into the event? How can I be better if I attempt to take it on the next time around? And that's ultimately what's really important. But to fear itself, no. Embrace it.
What's going through your mind at a time when you're close to breaking like that, whether it's physically, whether it's mentally? It's interesting hearing you talk about Fiji, yeah, and referring to it as an amazing experience. Most people will listen to that,
yeah,
and think, God, that sounds terrible. Same with the special forces. What is it inside your head that allows you to get through that barrier? And there are plenty of barriers in these moments.
Look, you know, I embrace life, and like I don't judge people, and I don't wish to be judged. I think as human beings, we should allow each and every individual to be themselves, to walk in their own shoes, to have the courage to be themselves. And that's critically important in life. And we should really celebrate that. And sometimes in Ireland and in the world, we tend to look at the gaps in people and never the gains. And we should look at the gains that people make. So if you're going to run a marathon, but you didn't get to the finish line, but I got 40 kilometres. Well, let's celebrate the 40 kilometres and not analyse the gap. And that's really, really important. And we should change that mindset completely. And we should allow people to be themselves. And if Jason Black wants to claim Everest K2 and race to the end of the earth, we should celebrate that. And equally at the same time, I have so much courage for people that are today getting out of their bed and claiming a bigger battle than I've ever claimed in my life. They're dealing with a disability. They're dealing with suicidal thoughts. They're dealing with depression. They're dealing with financial issues. They're dealing with bullying. They're dealing with all these incredibly horrific events in life, sadly. And they're having to deal with it nearly every day of their life. I don't. I've only had to deal with it for a short time. I'm just back from Africa at the weekend. I was out for 3 weeks there. And I was in the Congo for 7 days. And I was with young kids. And it was just a horrific situation, in a sense that you want to see the way these people have to live. Unfortunately, they have no money. And they're living in really tough, tough conditions. They're after coming through the civil war with, I was in Uganda, Rwanda and the Congo. And, you know, the effects of the Civil War are still there. The amputees, the broken families, the death and the devastation. Young kids that were caught in the as boy soldiers returned to their families in Rwanda that their mum and dad thought they were killed. This is all what we're doing. And, you know, the Irish Red Cross, and I'm an ambassador for them. They're out there doing that. And, you know, it just galvanizes the fact that we're here and we've got beautiful clothes in our back. We've got a lovely house. We've got a beautiful car. And we've got money in our pocket and we have a way around life, yet we're still not happy. And they're out there and they've got nothing and they're the happiest people you could meet. And I stayed with them. The most expensive meal I could buy off them was €150. And they would only take maximum €5 a night for accommodation. They give me their bed. And it was just the most grounding and galvanizing fact of life. So when you come back here, you look about your own challenges and your own battles and you think you should be giving out and crying and whinging and everything, and no, it's the opposite. I want to embrace life. I really, you know, while I'm on this planet and God gave me a gift to be here, I'm going to celebrate it and I'm going to enjoy it. And that might sound corny to some people. It might sound, you know, spiritually hairy-fairy, but that's me. That's how I'm living my life. And, you know, I want to celebrate everybody that I meet because goals are reflective of an individual. And they shouldn't be, nobody should want to follow my goals and my ambitions. They're mine. But what we should do is have the courage to celebrate each and every one of our goals and ambitions, no matter how big or how small they are. Because the small one to that individual is huge. And to a big one, to a certain individual, is quite normal.
Can I follow up that sublime piece with something vaguely ridiculous? We're doing Swim for a Mile at the moment.
Brilliant.
And it's going okay. Owen is...
He's the leading shark.
He's just starting out.
How's it going?
Not very well, Jason.
what's the limiting factor?
Here we go. This is actually very handy that you popped in. I drastically overstated my ability to actually swim, which is, believe it or not, important when you're swimming a mile. So
let me just fill in some context here. We're 5 weeks into a 12-week project, right?
Brilliant.
And Owen, when he first got in, was not great technically,
yeah,
and has just got good technically in the last 5 weeks. Has acquired a lot of skills. Is breathing over his shoulder. Is actually so. But I mean, you've literally climbed K2. So yeah. I'm just looking for a little bit of inspiration for him to drive him through the next 7 weeks, because he's already started to say, "Look, you know, I'll show up on the day, but I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to."
I haven't said that.
Yeah, you. These are direct quotes.
I would have given up by now if I didn't believe I could do it. So there's a possibility.
The belief is there. You got to train. Like, I mean, it's down to the black and white. You've got to get into the pool and address the demon. And but is that not where the magic lies? I mean, the fear of the unknown is magical. I have so much respect for somebody that's getting in, that's a non-swimmer, it's going to take on this a mile a week. Hopefully, it's for a charity or
for a cause.
And you had this one of the other warriors was on the show, Jerry Redmond. Pro to Prison. It was on the Off the Ball show, and he's a great coach based in Dublin. You should reach out to him and he'll give you some support. But just get in and be motivated. Have the motivation in your mind. It's not about you, and you're doing it for another reason. And sometimes that's what motivates me. If I selfishly look at me and think, well, I'm just doing this for my own egotistic way, it's not that. I don't give a damn about that. It's more about, well, my actions, I want to show that impossible is possible. And when you get into the water, that's exactly what you should do. So the length of the pool is you're making a difference in somebody else's life. And that's the difference. That is the motivation. There should be no other motivation required. You know that one length of the pool or that 1 mile that you're going to do every week is going to make a difference in somebody else's life, period.
So next step, the Atlantic, is what you're saying.
If it's in your mind.
what happens next for you then? Is there any challenge left out there beyond... on the menu already?
The word big three is huge for me, and I heard it there in the introduction. You know, the word big three is the Everest, the Race Across America, and the Road to the Atlantic. And, you know, I mentioned earlier on, is I am a very proud ambassador for the Irish Red Cross, and I'm a very proud athlete. It's not about me. It's actually about my actions to show that it's all possible. I spend a vast majority of my time, thankfully, today, and it's through the opportunity of adventure that the door opened into the schools. And I'm up and down Ireland and all over the world, and even last week in Africa. To stand in a classroom in Africa, kids are the same worldwide. They have the same ambition, they have the same curiosity, they have the same love for life. And it's just magical to be able to stand there as a human being, just this very ordinary person that was growing up in Donegal with two beautiful parents, and just say, look, you know what, I have my battles to deal with in life, which I spoke about on the show before, but I got past it and I've chosen to live an incredible life of adventure. And that's really important to me. And if my continuous journey continues to open that door, and inspiration's a word that doesn't sit well with me at all. It's more about empowering people. It's about, if my actions empower somebody else that's sitting there thinking, no, I can't. Well, I'm thinking, yes, you can. Because I can, you can. I've got to train hard, be committed, have a vision, have a dream, and be humble doing it. Well, then so can you. And the World Big Three is Race Across America next, 16th of June. And then the row across the ocean. And why that's important to me is I'm really touched by the migrant situation globally. I've met two of them of late, and that really inspired me to follow my dream, which was they're getting on a rubber dinghy. They've got no GPS. They've got no access to food or water when they're on a rubber dinghy. And they're setting sail for a better life somewhere else. And they do not know if they're going to hit land on the far side. A vast majority of them are perishing at sea. And the quest of finding something more special. And I want to show through it's about 45 days to row it, 5,000 kilometres. I'm going to hopefully show that what life's like for them. I'm going to be on a solo boat. I've got GPS. I've got a way with all to make water and have food available to me. And I'm still going to struggle. I'm still going to have all the battles, physical and mental torture to get across. But I'm going to try to paint a picture. I'm going to paint a picture of somewhat what it's like for a migrant. That's getting on a boat, a rubber dinghy, and they haven't a clue if they're going to see life again. That's my motivation.
However uncomfortable it sits with you, it is an inspirational story, and I hope many people do feel empowered watching it. And thanks very much for making the time to talk.
Thank you, I really appreciate it. And thanks very much for opening the door, because it's without a show like yourselves that brings a heightened awareness to it that it's lost.
Thanks very much. Tonight, Special Forces Ultimate Hell Week airs at 9:30 p.m. on RTE2. That is it from us this morning on OTBAM. Thanks very much for joining us. Off the Ball is going to be back on your radios on News Talk tonight from 7 o'clock. We had hurling with Ryan O'Dwyer. We had rugby with Alan Quinlan. We had football with Kenny Cunningham, Gary Breen and Sam Lee, and much more available on podcast. Wherever you get your podcasts, best places, go loud and offtheball.com/podcast. Tonight, rugby, Andy Mitten on Chelsea, Manchester United and much, much more besides. See you tomorrow. Good luck.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.